Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, where the island-chained nation sun shines from the Fukushima coast, and everybody gets extra rays when they're trying to soak them up. And my very special guest today is, with them rays, is got a very uniquely pronounced name, and he really hates it when people pronounce it wrong. And many do. So I'm going to allow him to introduce himself as well. What is your name, sir?
Eric Rice.
Eric Rice. Now, it's not spelt the way you think it is. It's A-R-I-K-R-E-I-S-S. All right? Like with the S-A from Mexico. Speaking of Mexico, it's one of the big things in the drug war and what have you. But anyway, he's the maker of the film Drug Lord, the documentary, which he is attempting to raise money for. So if you're listening to this right now and you think for yourself for a moment, how many billions do we spend on the drug war? How many people's lives are we destroying day in, day out by simply not doing anything about the ridiculous drug laws? And you might think there would be quite a lot of money. Might think it might be quite a lot of pain and suffering. And you might think that, hey, maybe it would be a good idea if somebody made like a couple of really, really hard-hitting documentaries with experts interviewed all over the way to Wazoo and not hold anything back. Such a endeavour is very rarely supported by the establishment viewpoint. And it is you, ladies and gentlemen, that we ask humbly for your donations so that we can actually finish this film. Eric needs about $3,200 and he needs it in the next 22 days. If anybody out there has ever suffered personally at the hands of the drug law, give him just a little something on his Kickstarter page, and we'll provide links with that on the audio archives and the YouTube videos and so on and so forth. But you can actually search it on Kickstarter, like, what was it, Drug Lord? Just search Drug Lord, L-A-W-E-D, on Kickstarter, should be there. And better yet, go to druglord.com, and everything's on there as well. Other than that, Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vinny.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, the film and whatnot for the uninitiated.
Well, it started about 4.5 years ago, and I've been shooting thousands of hours of footage and editing for the last 3 years to condense a very complicated story into 100 minutes. But if you watch that 100-minute film, which will be released in the next couple of months, you'll know everything you need to know to completely crush any prohibitionist argument that you might encounter from ignorant people who haven't really understood the costs, the true costs of the drug war that was initiated about 40 years ago by the very nebulous President Richard Nixon.
The nebulous president. Could you describe the word nebulous in this context? I'm confused.
Well, Nixon was a very conspiratorial president, and he was running all kinds of black ops and psy ops, and the drug war was one of his ops that was basically a way of controlling the population through restricting the kinds of drugs that they were allowed to have legal access to, and also through criminalization of the drugs that they were likely to be using, so that in Richard Nixon's particular political agenda, to destroy the anti-war movement. So that's where our drug laws come from. They were basically a means of controlling the population. They had very little to do with public health. In fact, they had nothing to do with public health. That's all just a sham.
Didn't Nixon say he wasn't a crook? And didn't he also accuse the people that accused him of being involved in conspiracies? Didn't he accuse them of being conspiracy theorists?
In fact, that's where the term conspiracy theory comes from. Richard Nixon was trying to deflect attention from the actual conspiracy that he was running to get information, inside information on the Democrats' campaign by bugging their campaign headquarters.
He bugged their campaign headquarters, mate. I didn't even hear that.
So, Nixon was a very crafty, very devious, very evil man, and this is who basically created our drug laws, the architect of our modern drug control system, and we need to break free of that. We need to move forward and create drug laws that are fostering the best public health outcomes. That's the essential need for government to control drugs, to foster positive public health outcomes. Currently, we're spending billions of dollars cumulatively, trillions of dollars, if you consider how many countries around the world have followed the U.S. model, have been coerced into following the U.S. model. We are finding there's more powerful, cheaper, and more prevalent narcotics of every stripe available every single day. You can't walk out your front door without tripping over a needle in some places, a heroin needle in some places in this town. So it's a very unsalubrious situation that the drug laws have created, and we need to be thinking about health, public health. Drug laws don't preserve the public health. They make the public health worse.
Specifically how?
Well, in the case of, let's say, cannabis, let's back away from the heroin example and talk about cannabis, which is what the film focuses on. If somebody actually does have a cannabis addiction and they get arrested, they're not going to get treatment, or they're very unlikely to get treatment in most cases, in a prison. In fact, when they are released from prison, they'll have now gone in with maybe an undergraduate degree in cannabis, and they may leave with a postgraduate degree in methamphetamine. They might be conscripted into a gang. They might be assaulted. They might have post-traumatic stress disorder from experiencing imprisonment. And if you try and find their victim, you can't. So they haven't actually hurt anyone.
My perspective is that the education system has a graduate course called prison. And that's a lot of the thing that's actually problematic about any kind of law, is that you wind up molding people in certain ways, and it's usually got unintended side effects.
Yeah, the unintended consequences of the drug war, well, there's an entire chapter dedicated to that in our film, the film that we're trying to raise money for, Drug Lord, which you can see at druglord.com.
There's nothing shameful about shameless self-promotion.
So in one of the chapters, we've divided the film into 10 chapters, so that if you are an internet viewer, and we're making it free for everyone in the world to see this film, this is basically our attempt to help foster better public education, and we're not trying to profit from it. If we do, that would be great. It would be nice to make some of the money back, but we're going to release the film free, and if you watch part 6, which is entitled The Costs of the Drug War, you'll see it's the longest segment of the film, because the costs of the drug war and the knock-on consequences of the drug war are so numerous that we needed to spend about 25 minutes of our 90-minute film just talking about those costs.
Well, costs like what? Just monetary or human costs as well?
There are financial costs. There are social costs. If you look at the straight financial costs in New Zealand, a very small country, we're actually outspending the United States at a ratio of 2-1 or 3-1, depending on which numbers you choose. But at a minimum, we are outspending them by a factor of 2-1. And what?
That's per capita.
Per capita, yes. Per capita, exactly. There are only just over 4 million people in New Zealand, 320 million in the US. But we're still arresting people at a higher rate per capita, and we're still spending on the prohibition at least double, per person arrested and processed through the criminal justice system. So if you break down that figure, and I'd like to remind international viewers, that international listeners, that New Zealand is a tiny country. So these figures are monstrous if you compare it to the size of the country. $64 million spent each year in incarcerating cannabis-only offenders. Those are offenders with no violent history, no other convictions. So there's additional costs on top of that.
Well, think of a reasonable sized city in the United States spending $64 million.
That's just on incarceration. It's $200 million on policing, excluding the costs of the Air Force and the Navy, who are also out patrolling for crops along the coast and inland by flying over in helicopter searches, and also in the eradication procedure. So you can add X million for those operations. Then you've got the costs of the court. You've got the cost of something like the Law Commission, which investigated these things and came up with a very well-rounded, very balanced report, very conservative report, advocating for the decriminalization of cannabis and the legalization of the medicinal use of cannabis. And that report was instantly binned. And the report itself cost a few million dollars to produce over a course of 3 years. I've got the exact numbers, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it didn't cover the costs of advertising and promotion of the actual document that they produced. So then we have the costs of people who've lost their job now going on social welfare, draining the public coffers because they've lost their job due to an arrest or a dismissal because they've been caught with a small amount of cannabis, often a negligible amount of cannabis. You've got the cost of dependents of people who are incarcerated claiming on social welfare because their breadwinner has been removed from their family. You've got the costs, the social costs to that family of losing a member of their family in a meaningless, pointless gesture of moralizing the law to suit your own political agenda by incarcerating a father who's otherwise a competent father and a family man. And I've met many people who've experienced this, and some of them are in the film, where a family member is ripped from his community, and a son now is, you know, his entire life can be changed because he doesn't have a father figure. And then when his father returns to him several years later, that father will be psychologically damaged from the incarceration, won't be the same father that he was before he went inside, wouldn't have been able to provide for his family during the period that he was incarcerated, so the family then has to rely on the benefit. In some cases, the cost is even greater when the police seize the home under the Proceeds of Crime Act, and then this family now is reduced to a state of impoverishment because of state-sanctioned theft. And in many cases, people who have lost their homes are really innocent of the charges that the police bring against them. The police have a stock-and-trade technique of drumming up the charge as much as possible, because then it gives them the pretense to seize property under the Proceeds of Crime Act. So in the case of a...
it's about the money for them, isn't it?
It is all basically a money go-around. The entire drug war can be summed up in two words: profit scheme. And
it's basic high school economics. When you cut off supply, you don't reduce the price, you make it skyrocket.
Exactly. Creating the black market that we see all around the world. The third largest black market on Earth, by the way. The first being arms, the second being the illegal oil trade. So number three, valued at $350 billion a year, accounting for a large percentage of world trade, is the illegal drug trade. Thank you, Richard Nixon.
Yeah, it's an old story, and it just keeps getting told over and over and over again. Don't you think that people are just kind of like sick of hearing about the drug war, even sick of hearing about protests about it?
People have become numbed to the message, even though the message has been on key basically since the earliest days of normal in the United States. They've been saying exactly the same thing. And even though it's filtering through slowly, it's not filtering through to the general population quickly enough. So that's what this film is about, helping people understand the minutiae of the argument so that there's no more debate about it. This basically is going to end the debate. So the debate about whether to legalize cannabis, at very least, is over. It is over. The United States government has acknowledged that by allowing the legalization of marijuana in Colorado and Washington states.
Technically, the United States didn't allow that. The states just do it themselves because they nobody in New Zealand has sovereignty.
Somewhat, yeah. They have a small degree of sovereignty. But in the case of Colorado and Washington, Attorney General Eric Holder, and we cover this in the movie Drug Lord, wrote a memo saying that the federal government will not seek prosecutions against legalized distribution of marijuana in those states when it does not contravene the state's own laws. So that's basically saying, go ahead, we are not coming after you.
Did that stop the DEA in California with all the coffee shops? Green Cross and all of that?
No, it did not. It did not. So we are taking a wait-and-see attitude, but it looks like Obama has given up the ghost on the drug war. Obama, let me just clarify something. Obama is no friend to the international marijuana community. And I say that despite the fact that he was a prime member of the Chum Gang in Hawaii. Growing up, he was notorious for being a hardcore pothead, stoner, reefer, blazing dude. He was at the center of that kind of activity at his high school growing up.
Sounds like presidential material to me, because you have to be a career criminal.
Yep. Well, you know, they say marijuana is the gateway drug. It's the gateway to being president of the United States of America, because the last three presidents, and probably a few before, including John F. Kennedy, used to do that in their youth. John F. Kennedy was probably doing that throughout the entire time he was president before he was assassinated. So, gateway to being the first four presidents of the United States, George Washington and the next three, all smoked pot. There's references to them doing it in their journals. They were all hemp farmers, incidentally. So, yes, the United States of America that gave us this prohibition has a very, very deep history and relationship with the cannabis plant. So where these prohibitions came from, it's a strange glitch that started about 1937, if you want to pinpoint where this historical glitch happened. But for the previous 10,000 years, humanity has coexisted with this plant like no other plant on the earth. It is the most useful plant on the planet.
If I take a sledgehammer to your computer and say it's not working anymore, is that a glitch? Because that's what they did, bro.
Yeah, it was more than I'm talking about a glitch in terms of historical time and humanity's relationship with the plant over the past 10 or 12,000 years, in fact.
Humanity's relationship with the plant never changed, because as far as I know, the drug law didn't stop anybody from smoking squat.
Well, it did change, because the drug laws have caused incarceration and widespread social strife. They've even caused disease outbreaks. So,
didn't it also cause higher drug use?
Oh, drug use has skyrocketed. In fact, if you look at the graphs which show where the drug war laws were initiated around the 1970s, you see a massive surge in drug use from that time continuing. And the more strident the drug laws are, the greater the drug use in any society, which is why we find that in Portugal and the Netherlands, where they've decriminalized the personal use and possession of drugs, drug use has declined quite markedly, especially amongst the youth, which is, of course, the whole reason why the vast edifice of these drug laws exists, to protect our children. Well, if you want to protect your children from drugs, you must decriminalize them, which decreases the likelihood of them using these drugs. So the entire patriarchal system of drug control is an absolute and abysmal failure in every single way.
Let's count the ways, shall we?
It's only a three-hour show, Vinny.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I mean, the whole documentary that you spent goodness knows how many years compressing into, like, the best freaking work of exposing the scumbaggery of the drug law the world has ever seen has taken goodness knows how long. So, we're not going to be able to list them all. I don't know, do you have, like, a short list, like bullet points and what have you?
Bullet points? Can we go country by country here? Because as the documentary points out, the drug laws have affected directly at least 156 countries on this earth that are the signatories to the UN conventions, which are basically a facsimile of United States drug policies. And the United States thought it would be a great idea if all the countries in the world would sign on to their version of drug hell, essentially. Although I should point out, there were some countries that were directly conquered through military invasion that didn't sign these drug laws. But the U.S. didn't have to worry about that because they were an occupying force and they simply changed their local laws directly. They also did that in Japan, where, in fact, hemp is still grown and continued to be grown throughout the prohibition just for the use of the emperor's clothing. So there was an exception made just for the emperor and a farm in a town called Asomara. Aso is Japanese for hemp. It basically means hemp village. They continued to grow despite the fact that it was illegal throughout Japan in all its forms. So the emperor was the only one who was legally allowed to use some form of cannabis, if only as clothing.
I guess he was the asshole.
Well, no, the Americans were the assholes. But I'm just pointing out how essentially the influence of America is either indirect through political and diplomatic pressure or direct through military invasion, through occupation. And I think, you know, I hate to bash America, and I have nothing against our American listeners out there, and I, you know, God bless you all. I hope you stand up and take control. I'm just getting off topic a bit, but your government's gone fucking crazy. Are we allowed to swear on this show, Vinny?
It doesn't matter. I guess you can.
So rail it in, and the whole system that we've imported from there. That's the essential problem. We've imported a failed system.
You know what we should have done? Instead of importing their drug policy, is just import the drugs that they grow.
Well, they're actually not a huge... except for meth. They're not a huge...
Maybe not so much meth.
They're California, Humboldt County.
I'm talking about in terms of what we'd like to import to New Zealand, you know.
Oh, right. Well, in terms of, though, to break it down, their consumption rates are much higher than their production rates. They're the world's number one consumer of drugs, by far. That's despite having these strident drug laws in place to supposedly curb the consumption of drugs. Well, your drug laws are strident and your drug use is out of control. Can you not figure out the connection?
What percentage of the world's heroin was being grown in Afghanistan the year before the US invasion?
Very small percentage.
I believe it was 1%. And what percentage were they exporting 1 year after the US invasion of heroin from Afghanistan?
I'd guess at about 20-25%.
It was like around 75-90%.
Wow.
Climbing over the next few years.
Really? Wow.
It's my contention.
Yes.
That unless that heroin was frickin' illegal, the CIA wouldn't be able to get a whole lot of money for black ops that they could just sell all these drugs on the streets to all these dealers and pass them out in the black communities. And
absolutely,
hey, you know, beautiful.
Absolutely, they did that. It's documented. Air America, where they were using cargo planes to fly guns into Laos and Cambodia, fly out with packed with heroin. They were selling the heroin to their own GIs when they were on leave in Laos and Cambodia. So, you know, the CIA has been doing this since the CIA was born. And the CIA has a huge, huge role in the drug war as well.
Does it have a huge role in the film?
No. We couldn't cover everything. We do though take a look at FBI director Louis Freeh's involvement in New Zealand drug laws, and how he paid a personal visit to then Prime Minister Jenny Shipley and put the hard word on her that she needed to toughen up on the cannabis laws, despite being advised by her health select committee that the cannabis laws needed to be changed and reformed. And she said at first, her first reaction to that advice was, yes, we're going to take a good look at this. This is a serious matter. And within a few days, Louis Freeh had showed up and had this private meeting with her. And they made a joint statement to the press soon after that meeting. I don't know if it was directly or if it was the following day, but soon after they made a joint statement to the press that the cannabis laws in New Zealand were going to be toughened, because they need to send a strong message that there's a zero tolerance policy and cannabis is a deadly drug, etc., etc. All the old lies were trotted out for the press, who lapped it up. Because the New Zealand press doesn't actually engage with the fucking... Sorry, I swore again. Now I'm going to go on a rant about the New Zealand press. But, yeah, you know, it's I feel like I'm in a bit of a war without bullets. You know, I hope that we win. I hope that the side of sense and decency and love and community prevails in this war, the spiritual war that we're experiencing now.
I think it's a public awareness war as much as anything, really. I think if people had known the truth, you know, from the outset, what's this marijuana stuff? Well, it's cannabis. Well, frankly, I'm not outlawing that. I use cannabis all the time. My doctor treats me with it and everything. I make my clothes out of it. I freaking feed my kids with it. I use my animals for feed.
Animal feed, bedding.
So, you know, I can build my freaking house out of that stuff. And you're telling me that it's a good idea to make it illegal? Okay, just because you call it a fancy name, marijuana, which means Mary Jane, which is Mary and Jane, you know? Well, what do you think?
It was a great trick. It was a fantastic trick because many of the people who voted for that law had no idea that they were using cannabis and that they were making their own medicine, their own clothing, their own building material, their own etc. illegal. They had no idea it was the same substance that they were talking about. And I just want to drop in a little nugget from history at this point about where this term comes from. And everybody knows it was Randolph Hearst who popularized the term. But why he made that particular selection, that particular word, features in the song La Cucaracha. And that was the song that was being sung by the soldiers of Pancho Villa, who nationalized huge swathes of Randolph Hearst's forests in Mexico, which he had bought up to make paper. And so not only did he hate Mexicans for doing this, he was already a racist, but he particularly hated Mexicans because they took control over this land that he had probably bought up dirt cheap through some shady deal with the Mexican government that Pancho Villa overthrew. So he took this the word used in their song, in their freedom anthem, and he popularized that word as this ulterior word for this new killer Mexican loco weed. So it was no accident that he called it that. He had a bone to an axe to grind with those particular Mexicans, with that particular subgroup of Mexicans, yeah. And he ground it pretty well.
I was just trying to steal some land, that's it.
So yeah, the tree connection, the forestry connection, then of course many people know about, was because of paper and the success that cannabis was finding with new technology in the paper making process, and Hearst wouldn't allow the competition. So
Don't you find that kind of ironic, how it was a war between paper and weed?
It was a war between, yeah, it was a war between resources.
Yeah, but don't they kind of need each other, you know?
Yeah, yeah, they do, they do. They do indeed. But very clever people, very insidious people have created the system that we're living in today. These people are all dead. Nixon's dead, Hearst is dead, Anslinger's dead, but their ghosts are still in charge. You know, they have more power now in terms of shaping the world than they did when they were alive, just because of their legacy.
You know, what occurs to me now is that so many people have left a legacy, so many people have left a mark on the world, marks that may never actually ever go away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and like war, for example, it just never freaking ends. It's always going on. Why? Because, oh, well, there's a whole bunch of people in the military-industrial complex who want all the money in the world and don't really want to share it, so they've found a convenient way to do both. Kill all the people that might share their wealth, and make wealth while they're killing them.
Absolutely. War is the number one business on this planet, by far. There's not even a close second.
Drugs, you know.
No, you got to get down. Especially the oil, CIA, then drugs. Let's.
But it is gold, oil, and drugs. Those are our god. Gold, oil, drugs. Yeah.
But in terms of how the drug war ties in with the military-industrial complex, now it's overt. You've actually got a slave labor force in American prisons and in UK prisons as well, who are being paid $2 a day to manufacture the parts of weapons that go into bombs that get dropped on other countries. So Halliburton and the Carlyle Group not only bilk the taxpayer by not having to pay taxes on their slave labor force, who they are paying a tuppence to produce these weapons, but then Halliburton can then drop bombs on U.S. citizens, which they've done through error, and they still get paid for those bombs. They still get paid. It's not like that the U.S. taxpayer can demand a refund when Halliburton accidentally kills some of American soldiers in now Afghanistan, and they're still in Iraq, even though the war is technically over. But this has happened where they bombed their own soldiers. It's not like the U.S. taxpayer can demand a refund on the cost of those bombs. You know, that money's in Halliburton's bank account. So, sorry guys, we drop bombs on our own guys. Too bad, we still get paid.
Now, if we're talking about the military-industrial complex, so Eisenhower warned people about this, didn't he? You know, mm-hmm. He didn't say, hey, well...
This is his final address to the American people.
I mean, just think about that. You know, my last chance to tell the American people something, and instead of saying, thank you, I've been a great president, or anything, he says, I'm warning you, there's a bunch of criminal scum who can have a huge quantity of stuff. Oh, we've got a phone ringing. And who can... basically, take over the country and enslave all of you. That was the last thing he decided to tell people as President of the United States. And they completely ignored him. Didn't they?
Yeah, they did. And
as a result of them ignoring the warnings, you now have an enormous system where the exact thing that he warned against happening has already happened. There are military-industrial scumbags in charge of everything, you know? Isn't that the way of things, ladies and gentlemen, that every single time that somebody gives you some really good advice, you ignore them and keep doing what you're doing anyway?
In fact, that is the pattern. I'd just like to point something out about Eisenhower, in that he was one of the key presidents to build up the military-industrial complex. And he only recognized the error of his ways right at the end. But he's definitely not blameless. And if Eisenhower had woken up to the threat that he was himself creating, maybe he would have acted differently. But I don't think he was really in control. I think that the American presidents are mainly puppets, and their masters twiddle their strings and they talk. And then after he was released from the presidential obligations that he had signed on for, he was able to speak a little bit more freely. So that was the message of his closing address. But we've seen a massive militarization throughout the world based around the drug war. The drug war, Professor David Nutt points this out in our films, in the film Drug Lord. He says that the DEA are perhaps the number one threat to world peace in terms of the way they've militarized zones of the world through the enforcement of their drug policies and their eradication programs.
And this actually sounds all too familiar. Have you ever noticed how every single time they say, oh, we're going to solve this problem for you, it's actually them that caused the problem in the first place, or there was no problem there in the first place at all? And then guess who profits by these solutions that they're going to propose? It'll save everybody from these problems that they either caused or never existed.
It's the law enforcement agencies, it's the prison industrial complex currently under the control of Serco, the same people who build nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, a UK multinational. So it's like I said, it's a profit scheme. Serco builds the weapons, Serco houses the prisoners, Serco controls the crowd. That's one of the other things they do. They do crowd control, sort of paramilitary operations. They're bad people. They're not the kind of people that you want the government of this country to be signing indefinite contracts with, which is what their control over two private prisons in this country has wed the government to.
Definitely not indefinitely. That would be... That'd be very, very nice and damn skippy, would it not? However, it occurs to me that public policy does not get made by the people that the policy governs. They get made by people above the law.
Yeah, the way the lawmaking process...
Could you elucidate on that, actually? How equally are these drug laws applied? Are the rich just as likely to get busted for pot on the side of the street as a poor person?
The chances of you being arrested and prosecuted and going to prison and all of, you know, the rollout of an arrest, at each stage, it is higher depending on your race, and lower depending on your income. So, for example, in this country, the most likely group of people to be arrested are Maori males. Young Maori males are the number one group of people being arrested in New Zealand. They're four times more likely to be stopped and searched. They're seven times more likely to be arrested. They're seven times more likely to... be charged. They are five times more likely to be convicted, and when convicted, they are five times more likely to receive a prison sentence than a white defendant. So these statistics are borne out in the United States in almost identical ways in terms of black. You substitute black male for Maori male, and you see basically an exact same chart in terms of how people are arrested and discriminated against based on their race and their income.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like eugenics to me.
Well, it could be considered that way. You're definitely filtering out a certain segment of the population and reducing their chances of procreating. So it is a form of eugenics. It's definitely shaping the population. In America, you've got one in four black men having been arrested. That's an obscene number, you know. In New Zealand, you've got 15% of the Maori population has been arrested. 15% is a very scary statistic. So, you know, there has to be some kind of... Sorry. Let me correct that. 15% of the population is Maori, and 51% of the prison population is Maori. So that's a huge disproportion in terms of the representation of the population in the prison compared to the general population. We've got to change these because we're disenfranchising huge swathes of the population.
I think that's the agenda. Who benefits?
Ki bono, exactly. And... And in this case, it's rich white guys who benefit. It tends to be. Rich white guys set up the drug laws that we have. Harry Anslinger, Richard Nixon, Randolph Hearst. In fact, I'm going to mention that I think the key figure in the entire conspiracy against the cannabis plant was a former Treasury of the U.S. Secretary, Andrew Mellon, who was at that time one of the richest men, if not the richest man in America, who financed the DuPont Chemical Company, and who also financed the Mellon Institute of Research, which produced the research that said that fluoride's good for your teeth back in the 1930s. And based on that bogus research from 84 years ago, however long, we still fluoridate our water, even outside of the U.S. This stupid idea has caught on.
Incidentally, you know how you were telling us the statistics of, Maoris in prison and the blacks in prison and all that kind of thing because of the drug war? Well, I saw a stat that fluoride affects black people's teeth worse and Hispanic people's teeth worse than white people, and in some cases, twice, if not three times as badly.
Really? I it wouldn't surprise me. Fluoride is not good for you. Anyone who's listening to this should stop drinking fluoridated water. I try to avoid it myself, but it's very difficult. You don't actually know what they're putting in the water. It could be something much worse than fluoride, and you better hope it's pharmaceutical-grade fluoride, because it's usually just toxic fluoride that's waste material. So thanks for listening.
With like about 17 trace minerals and stuff in it, you know, all conspiracies tie into all other kinds of conspiracies, and you know, that's the problem with being a proud conspiracy theorist as I am, is that I just think that nothing's too crazy, really. Everything seems to have a reason for people suspecting it, and if it comes from an official source, it's most likely the direct opposite of whatever they're saying it is. Cannabis is evil, it's useless, it destroys your brain, it kills your liver, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just all bollocks.
It is. Ronald Reagan came up with some corkers. I mean, back in the day when he was president, he made a statement that marijuana could turn out to be the most dangerous drug that is in use in our country today. And the preamble to that statement was that he's disappointed in the media for not bringing attention to the subject, when the media were basically yapping zero tolerance throughout his entire zero tolerance campaign that his wife orchestrated. So the media was being extremely obedient, but he was nevertheless disappointed in them. And very few people know that Reagan himself was a salesman for Chesterfields. He was a salesman for the tobacco companies, and he did that for a long time. I mean, you see him age throughout these endorsement photographs. He ages over a period of about 35 years. So he was doing that for a while. I mean, promoting cigars, promoting Chesterfields. There's a Christmas ad of him holding up a pack of Chesterfields, saying get your friends a carton of Chesterfields for Christmas. So this is the same dude who claimed that marijuana is the most dangerous drug in America, when cigarettes kill 500,000 Americans every year. It's by far the number one killer drug in America, and in fact in the world. I'd like to just drop this number on people: 6.3 million deaths per year, according to the World Health Organization, caused by cigarettes, and an additional 600,000 deaths per year, 300,000 of them children, from secondhand smoke, pushing our total to just under 7 million deaths a year from Ronald Reagan's second favorite drug, because I think he had a penchant for alcohol.
Which is again dwarfed by a new study of the American Medical Association, which was found to kill 40 million people a year.
Yeah, alcohol is the most, in terms of social harms and in terms of harms to the user, alcohol vies for first place with heroin as the most dangerous drug. And depending on which index you use, it's actually number one.
I'm talking about like hospital accidents and stuff like that. You know, just you're actually more likely to be killed by a doctor than anything. Did you know that?
Oh, right.
And also, if you have the letters MD after your name, I found this out earlier, you're 11 times more likely to be a serial killer.
11 times more likely. That's interesting. That's interesting. I'm glad I'm not a doctor.
I'm not saying all doctors are killers. It's just you're 11 times more likely to be one.
Right, right. Well, there's an interesting study in New Zealand about health professionals that found that they use cannabis at a far higher rate than the average population. So maybe we need to get those serial killing doctors high, and
I'm not sure it would help because there's a reason why doctors are on drugs themselves, on prescription medications, are heavy drinkers, heavy smokers, and all of that. Okay, is because I believe that the medical industry got taken over by the Rockefeller Foundation, basically. All right, and now they teach everything. They tell you, okay, well, you're going to use drugs. Why are these drugs? What are they made out of? Well, they're made out of waste products that we can't actually use in our petroleum products. You mean like waste stuff from a well that doesn't break down and is really dangerous and stuff like that and has psychoactive effects? Yeah, those kind of drugs. Are you telling me that these are the only things that we can prescribe people now in order to help them with diseases and none of these drugs cure? Yep, that's right. Okay. That's really depressing. I think I might go smoke some weed.
It is depressing. It's basically like what you describe, except they use, sexy women, and I've met them, to seduce these doctors into buying their drugs, wining and dining them. They have massive budgets. They get paid really well. And they're not just women. They're men as well. Pharmaceutical reps I'm talking about. And they cajole these doctors into taking, the drug, testing it, prescribing it. They get their kickbacks. They get their Diners Club card, verified. Who knows what they're getting. But they're getting sweet deals from these pharmaceutical companies who are spending $100 billion a year to advertise their toxic products to the general population so that you become a lifelong dependent on whatever product it is that you were unfortunate enough to be prescribed.
And they only give you drugs that you can't grow yourself.
That's true. Or, in the case of GW Pharmaceuticals, profit off the fact that you cannot grow cannabis, whereas they have three gigantic warehouse facilities in the United Kingdom producing very high-grade medicinal marijuana. So their market share is legally protected. They're loving it. They're loving it. And they're loving the fact that a little spray of Sativex costs $500, and that'll last you 1 week. So if you have MS, well, you better have $500 a week for your Sativex, because you can't get it any other way legally in this country.
You're going to be freaking kidding me. It's almost worth the risk getting busted, isn't it?
Oh, well, many people are taking that risk. And, with the prevalence of use in this country, it being tied with Australia for number one in terms of its consumption of cannabis, even though there are so many people being arrested, there's just this vast group of people who are growing, distributing, and never having any interdiction with the law. Because just of the numbers, the police are overwhelmed. They're scurrying about as fast as they can to arrest as many people as they can, and they're not even making a dent in the overall population who are using.
Just dents in individuals' lives that kind of destroy them forever.
Big dents in the individual's life, but no dent in terms of... In fact, as we pointed out, they're having the opposite effect, because as you drive up the price through these scurrilous legal maneuverings, you incentivize people from entering that black market. Incentivization is what drives the economy, and that's what was a gigantic gift to crime when they made drugs illegal. The biggest gift to crime ever. In fact, organized crime was based around the prohibition of alcohol. So thank you very much for that stupid prohibition, because all the other organized crime networks that developed in the United States after the 1930s were established during that period.
I thought they called that the Senate.
Oh, well, that's another gang. There's a lot of gangsterism that the documentary hints at in terms of governmental gangsterism. That, this cabal of people that made marijuana illegal and the cabal of people that perpetuates the prohibition are themselves a gang, and they operate as a gang. The only difference is that you, the taxpayer, give them a salary, as well as the other little income streams that they manage to generate through their gang activity.
Which is why I would prefer to be governed by the mafia, Because at least when I give the mafia protection money, I get protection.
You get protection, exactly. Exactly. You're giving protection money to the state of the gang state. Currently, the chief gangster is your Prime Minister, John Key, who is a financial crook. Anyone out there who thinks that John Key is cool, go kill yourself. He's not a cool person. He is a bad man.
He's not being too harsh. Seriously, kill yourself. You have nothing of use to offer the human race.
Exactly. Your genes should be extinguished.
You should sell all your assets. You should sell all your assets. Get yourself massively in debt, okay? That's the best thing for you. Because then you will be homeless, destitute, and die of your wounds.
I better not rant too much about Johnny K because I'm going to be applying for my citizenship in a few months. And I don't want some of his agents.
Swear. Yeah, but you don't have to swear allegiance to JK.
Please, Johnny K. Don't kick me out.
Please,
don't
Johnny
kick
K.
me out.
That should be quite funny to see you.
I retract my earlier statement. No, he's a powerful man. I don't know if people out there know, but he was a Merrill Lynch bankster before he became Prime Minister of New Zealand. And this is my prediction, listeners out there, that in approximately 6 months, just before the next general election, Johnny Kay is going to bring his friend Barry O out here so that they can have a little powwow and look presidential next to each other. And that's what's going to win Johnny Kay a third term. Just that PR stunt. That alone is going to make stupid New Zealanders vote for him. That PR stunt alone is going
you
to
mean
win the election.
Bringing over the US president who in his first term, maybe even his first year if I remember correctly, borrowed more money than all previous presidents combined. He will come
fiscal
over
responsibility,
here in
baby.
Order to back up the re-election campaign of the man who got elected in 2008. And in his first term or his first year, I remember correctly, borrowed more money than any other New Zealand prime minister in history.
Yep, the pattern there is difficult to ignore. And
it doesn't stop there. They also both come from a blue political party, and
that's right.
They were also both elected in 2008.
That is, and they were both working for financial institutions at some point. In fact, I think it's the same financial institution. They both worked for Merrill Lynch. So you might want to fact check me out there, listeners at home, but I believe they both worked for Merrill Lynch.
You know what I reckon? They're having sex.
I wouldn't put it past John Key to be some kind of, you know, I'm not saying gay is deviant, but some kind of deviancy there, you know, probably not something we want to talk about.
Like an artificially sweetened deviant, like a steviant.
A steviant. I think John Key is probably going to invest in robotics to make some kind of a robot sex doll that he can have sex with. I think that's his particular stripe of deviancy. Because he's not completely human, so he cannot enjoy having sex with a human.
Well, you can't say that he's not completely human. I mean, he did deny that he was a reptile.
Did he? Did he actually make that formal denial?
Yes. The media forced a denial out of him. They got a denial that he was a reptile.
Really? Well, I'm still not convinced. I mean, he's definitely a cold-blooded individual. Wow, that's a powerful picture. Let me see that again. Sorry, viewers at home. Put that up on the screen. No, leave my branding. In case we never put the podcast out, we've got some great branding behind me for the film Drug Lord, Druglawed. Go to our Kickstarter campaign. And give us some money to finish this film, please. We're going to be distributing this all over the world. You'll be able to download it on the internet. We've got t-shirts ready. If we ever put the podcast out, you'll see the Drug Lord t-shirt that I'm wearing now. You can get those on the Kickstarter site. Please visit us. And even a small donation of $1 is something that helps us because it ups the number of people who've backed us and then creates confidence in the people who subsequently see the Kickstarter page.
Yeah, who knows? It might get rolling, you know. We had this picture of John Key on the cover of Crime Magazine, you know, like Time Magazine, except it's Crime.
Crime Magazine. Yeah, there he is.
Yeah, Prime Sinister.
Smiling.
It's just some kind of a demonic
grin.
It's the bangster smile, bro. The bangster smile. It is. You know? It's real nasty. And we've also got. I've got so many pictures of him on the website. Like, honestly, he's been putting the dick in dictator in this country since 2008. I assure you, ladies and gentlemen. And we kind of turned into a nation of sheep, ironically, for New Zealand.
It is.
Well, you know what was real funny, Eric, actually? I'm going to tell you this. John Key had so many articles in TV3 and TVNZ and frickin' The Herald and every single other form of New Zealand media and scum in this country, right? Saying that he lied about something, all right? He lied about this. He lied about that. He slipped them off on this and that. And then, article comes out. John Key, guess who's the most trusted and most liked? Prime Sinister.
M2's Man of the Year, John Key. He was on the cover of M2. Now, and I have to scratch my head in wonder at the total lack of discernment of the New Zealand media, the mainstream media, yourself accepted.
Well, and the people themselves. I mean, like there was a study that went out that they said, I think, like 40% of respondents said that John Key was sexy, and which I think highlights the drinking problem that we've got in this country.
Yep, we definitely have a drinking problem in this country. Alcohol is the number one drug problem in this country, listeners. There's a binge drinking culture. 10% of Kiwis are alcoholics, according to a recent study. You know, it's pretty much out of control. You see, when the All Blacks run out on their rugby field to bash each other senseless and everybody cheers, they got Lion Nathan's branding all over them. So their principal sponsor is an alcohol company, an international alcohol company. The public picks up the cost, the $16 billion annual cost, excluding knock-on costs, of damage through alcohol.
Knock-on costs? Is that a rugby pun?
No, not really. Not really. I want to get off the subject of rugby in case we have New Zealand listeners who disapprove of me pointing out the fact that rugby is costing your health system almost as much as cannabis prohibition. Not quite, but a large percentage of your health costs are borne by rugby.
Who ever thought that rugby was hazardous to your health? You know, you ever thought the massive tackles and all the injuries would have possibly given that one away earlier? But we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Arik Rice is my guest, and we'll be right back, folks. Don't you go anywhere. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It is now hour number two, and we're going to go straight through from hour two to hour three. Perhaps there might be a quick, sneaky WikiLeaks snicked in there at some point, but it's going to go straight through rather than the thing, because my very special guest, Arik Rice, has to go home. All right? I don't have to say it twice. And we're talking about Drug Lord, the documentary. They've got a little thingy on Kickstarter there. And if you can't donate some money in order to finish this film, just...
It's not a donation. You're pre-ordering the DVD, the T-shirt. Have a look at the Kickstarter, and you'll see it's not just a gift. It's you're getting something for your cash.
All right. Well, in that case, go and purchase something for a product that is not yet made.
Well, no, the T-shirts, for those of you who are watching the podcast, which we may put online, this is the T-shirt, the official movie T-shirt I'm wearing right here. screen printed by a very good artist, Dallas. Excellent screen printing on this t-shirt. It's a high quality.
I thought that was a TV show.
No, 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 no. You're confusing that with some other kind of Dallas. No, the man's name is Dallas, and he's a screen printing artist. He's not a regular kind of screen printer. This man is sharp.
So he's not a ex-porno guy? He wasn't in Debbie Does Dallas?
No, no, no connection to that film.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm taking it in a terrible direction. And something that rhymes with direction. And when you talk about the movie, which is probably the whole purpose of it. Now, let's see if we can run through the film, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. You know, incidentally, we've got 120 minutes. We've got 120 minutes to cover a 100-minute film.
That's right, but we're going to cut that film down to 90 minutes, so that's why this 120-minute interview is going to rocket along at a huge pace. To give people a sense of the pace of the film when it's completed, it's a very dense film, but it's like a roller coaster ride, which you know you're feeling the complexities at every turn because the story twists and turns at a rapid rate through the last 100 years of history, actually. Well, for example, the most recent turn was the legalization, the full legalization of cannabis in Washington and Colorado. Basically, this puts the United States in violation of UN treaties which it itself crafted and which the rest of the world has signed. So if the United States can violate these UN treaties, then other countries, including New Zealand, can also, because obviously these are not binding treaties. So that's a massive game changer, and the number of countries that recognize that and change their drug laws could have a domino effect, which means the entire prohibition, not of drugs generally, I don't believe, I'm not that hopeful, but of cannabis, could fall over within the next 10 years.
10 years, you say. And how many years have we got a prohibition so far, like 70?
Well, it depends if you take the starting point, 1906, which is when the first cannabis prohibitions were introduced, or 1937 when it was made federally illegal in the United States, or 1971 when Richard Nixon declared the modern drug war. So we're talking about just over 100 years or the last 40 years if you're just talking about the modern drug war era.
The modern drug war era, I think it should be pronounced more correctly.
Yeah, it was a gigantic era. One of the most costly blunders in terms of public policy that's ever been. Possibly the most costly public era.
Can we eliminate the need for mistakes and possible quaffling and whatnot? It was done deliberately by specific scumbags for a very, very evil agenda. And it's very, very obviously fits the definition of a conspiracy, doesn't it?
It was indeed a conspiracy. If you look at Richard Nixon's conspiracy, it involves appointing a conservative Republican governor, Raymond Schaefer, who actually refused to co-conspire with Nixon and published a report saying that marijuana should be decriminalized. So Nixon binned the Schaefer Commission's report, had Schaefer discredited using the power of the other people who were tied to the Oval Office and the newly created Drug Czar Office. They created a set of drug laws that were in direct contradiction to what the Schaefer Mission's findings, very conservative findings, stipulated. So Nixon definitely gerrymandered the laws. He took the laws into his own hands. In fact, more than taking the laws into his own hands, he created laws which were then in his hands from that time until his demise as president.
He's got the drug laws
in his hands. No, let's not sing. This is a family-friendly show. We don't want the dogs howling in the background. Nixon was a very evil character. And we shouldn't be following him blindly into the abyss, which is what we've been doing globally since the time he concocted the drug war fiasco.
Conveniently, he's dead, right?
It's convenient and inconvenient. I mean, if he was still alive, you know, we could hold him accountable.
We could do a documentary about him called An Inconvenient Douche.
Have you used that one before? It's fresh. That was fresh, listeners at home.
Yeah, they get worse. For my haters, yes, there is more to come.
Nixon, I don't know how familiar people are with Nixon, because he's been dead a long time. As you point out, he is dead. But Nixon had some great little personal stories involving Elvis Presley and the drug war, and conscripting Elvis Presley as a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. The irony being that Elvis was himself an alcoholic and pharmaceutical drug addict, and died as a result of ingestion of those drugs. So that was one of his PR stunts to get other countries like New Zealand. This actually worked to get New Zealand on board with the drug war. So celebrities back then were doing what they're doing now in terms of serving the ruling agenda.
I heard that Elvis died for a couple of reasons, right? There's drug and everything. He wasn't a very healthy man, but allegedly
he was not healthy.
Allegedly he was whacked, all right? Because when he was recruited, he was like real anti-drug and stuff like that, and then he just wanted to kind of infiltrate and do his part for the country and that kind of thing, get into the drug scene because a whole bunch of people invited him because he was freaking Elvis, you know. And of course, if you're a massive big rock star, you get offered all the drugs and everything. So he offered himself to the US government, and they used him. The problem is he got so deep in that he started to realize that it was the US government dealing the drugs, and he was going to start talking about it, allegedly, and then he died, conveniently.
I've been to his home, and I've visited his final resting place. I've seen the bullet holes in the TV, and he was definitely exhibiting a lot of signs of deep alcohol dependence, you know, in terms of his violent and erratic behavior, you know, shooting off firearms and so forth. He was definitely acting as an agent of the government. I don't know if we can ever prove your contention that it was an assassination. But it's
not mine either. There's a good Stu Webb. He's been a government whistleblower for like 15 years or something.
No. It's not beyond the realms of imagination. But the government, and specifically the CIA, were definitely in the drug trade at that time that Elvis was overdosing. In fact, you see that that time it was Air America, the heroin trafficking from Southeast Asia, that morphed into the Iran-Contra scandal, once again, weapons and drugs involved in that, where a democratically elected Central American government was overthrown by a coup funded by cocaine, and the arms were supplied and the drugs were trafficked by the CIA under the command of General Oliver North, who actually confessed to doing this. And later on, got a show on the Fox News Network. So that's how it rolls, man. Confessed to major drug trafficking and arms trafficking, and get a TV show as punishment.
You would have to deal with all of those television types, you know. Sometimes
that's true. That could be grueling.
They can be kind of. I guess the word really has to be scumbaggery, just again, you know. There's just a general air of scumbaggery about mainstream media that I feel it's palpable, you know. It's like cockroaches crawling on your skin at night when you sleep.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been through the door, and I've seen the other side, and I think they're just human beings at the end of the day who don't understand the bigger picture. I empathize with people in the marketing world as individuals, but and marketing and media, but in general, no. I think that these edifices are serving the purposes of a ruling cabal that does not have your spiritual and human needs at heart at all.
If anything, it's the direct opposite, isn't it? You know.
No, it is. It's a.
Well, people always argue, you know, they go like, "Oh, why would somebody be like so corrupt as to create an entire drug scheme that makes billions of dollars for private weapons contractors and creates an enormous black market by which the government can finance all its black secret ops?" I don't understand why somebody would do that. It just seems crazy. It's like, yeah. Well, that's because you're not a criminally negligent psychopath. Yeah. Okay, you know, if you were suddenly, I get it. I get it.
Yeah, well, the trust in government is astonishing, considering the fact that, like in the case of Oliver North, he confessed in front of a grand jury to his crimes under oath, and even then, there's no accountability or belief that the government is untrustworthy, that they're not capable of wrongdoing when they've confessed to it. So what haven't they confessed to, what is completely unknown and will never be known, is beyond the realms of the imagination. But what we do know is damning enough on its own, what we've proven and what's already been confessed to.
Yeah. And you can't make this stuff up either. You know, even if I was to dream up the wildest, craziest conspiracy theory with all the bloody players and the length of it, I couldn't make it up as brilliantly as it has already been made.
No, these are masters of theatre on the global scale. I mean, look at the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is the inciting incident of the drug war, because it was to crush the resistance to that war that Nixon crafted the drug laws in the way that he did. But the Gulf of Tonkin incident is a classic false flag operation, which Robert McNamara confessed to, the Secretary of Defense, confessed that they'd made up the radio report of a torpedo attack on one of their naval vessels in the Gulf of Tonkin, that it was an absolute fabrication, and Robert McNamara admitted that, and nobody has held him or Henry Kissinger or all of the other warmongers, including Nixon, accountable, Lyndon B. Johnson. None of them were ever held accountable for war crimes. None of them were ever held accountable for misleading the public. None of them were ever held accountable for the hundreds of thousands of dead GIs, 50,000 dead GIs from the Vietnam War, hundreds of thousands permanently scarred, psychologically and physically scarred. You know, the atrocities that these people committed were, you know, on a scale of Hitler and Stalin. They're at that level, genocidal, ecocidal, sociopathic behavior on the global scale, and none of them have ever been held accountable. In fact, when Nixon died, all the other still living presidents and ex-presidents and president turned out to salute him as his corpse was lowered into the earth instead of being thrown to the pigs and eaten by pigs, which is what he deserved. So, yeah, there's this hero worshipping that goes on towards the United States president and his aides and his generals and his entourage that is really bizarre. It's like almost a religious cult. And, you know, how do you bring down an edifice of that size and of that reach? It's like a David and Goliath struggle that we fight.
I do believe you're right on this particular front. You know, like odds are set against us allegedly. I mean, we've got the numbers, but they got the technology and the brainwashing and the money and the history of the whole public's just been educated basically since they first go into school to blindly obey authority.
Exactly. Schools are very similar to prisons in the way they're built, their architectural style, in terms of the way they're run, in terms of the way they are now surveilled, you know, with CCTV cameras. That's basically how people begin their education as state programmable automatons, because it's very hard to get an independent syllabus, especially in the United States. So you're either going to be homeschooled or you're going into this concentration camp of the soul, you know, where you will be instructed on how to serve economic growth and to fit in as a little wheel in this gigantic watch that is the globalized economy.
Yeah. It's a succubus of a syllabus, isn't it?
It is. It is very succubus. And, and how many people out there can ever step away from their formative years and, like, begin to look at the world objectively? So if they get you from a young age, they get you from age 4, age 5, and they institutionalize you. Now, I come from a background where corporal punishment was part of the tradition, in fact. It was an integral part of how the school operated. You know, using a cane, you know, 6 of the best, that was a very painful experience and humiliating as well to have some sociopathic teacher with, you know, all kinds of unresolved issues from his own childhood hit you with a cane repeatedly on your buttocks. It can leave scars on your mind as well. So this is how 1,000 boys from my schooling days were treated for 5 years. Ridiculous. And that's kind of like the way governments, not to that level where corporate punishment is used, but hazing, other forms of physical abuse are still part of school routines, not just in America, but in a lot of countries. So, we're teaching people to be bad, essentially, to be bad and frightened and retaliatory.
Yeah, the old public school started up in Prussia, I think it was, and they were quite surprised when they went to war with France, like this prior to the First World War, that they had all these kids that just lined up, you know, to be bossed around by a guy in uniform. You know,
they loved it.
And they resoundingly beat the French, and then the French and everybody else in the entire world says, "Oh my God, look at how easy it is to indoctrinate children to view the state as something worth dying for and giving up their lives willingly. Let's institute that here." And then the first schools in the United States, they actually had to get rangers like on cavalry back to lasso children and drag them to school from their parents.
They actually kidnapped them. Is that I wasn't aware of that. That's
man. Public schools are bitch.
Yeah, I remember from my school days when we had cadets, that was on Fridays, and you couldn't just go home and enjoy your weekend. No, you had to make fucking squads and march in formation on the rugby field up and down and do these drills like a sweaty mutant and listen to some doofus shout orders at you. And I think the only people who really enjoyed it were the doofus people shouting the orders. Everybody else hated it. But it was a kick for the guy in charge. And I think that's been a huge driver in a lot of people's lives where during their school years they got to be captain of a team or class president or some other silly little meaningless accolade that gave them the approbation that they craved. And it's part of the way they're controllable now because they seek that same approbation, status, through a fancy car or a, you know, job title that other people will gasp at in awe. And it's because at school he was told to value a certain thing. But if he had been homeschooled by me, and incidentally I have some qualifications as a teacher and I do teach children art and cartooning, so I have direct experience of this. If I get to educate a child, that child will grow up to be a free thinking individual. When the state gets to educate your child, that child will grow up to be a consumptive conformist. And that's what we have. We have a population of consumptive conformists out there through the state education system.
Addicted consumptive conformists.
Yep, indeed. Addicted to many things, not just drugs, although drugs are one of the most overt things. Addicted to television. Addicted to cheeseburgers. Addicted to a lot of cheap thrills and instant gratification. And I'm just going to do a quick shout-out now to Madiba, my president, who died recently, Nelson Mandela. May his soul rest in peace. Madiba once said, and I'm going to say this in my Madiba voice, and this is not my Yoda voice.
This is not his more higher pitch voice. This is Madiba voice.
Not a Yoda voice, this is.
The Madiba voice is different from the Yoda voice, and this is the Madiba voice.
The culture of instant gratification is problematic. People must delay the gratification to experience joy.
And I think he summed it up like that. You know, instant gratification is a big problem. People haven't recognized it, and they don't know why they seek it.
I think it's actually quite a painful experience just to be alive when there is nothing to live for. And what instant gratification basically teaches you is that unless you have everything you want right now, there's nothing to live for. Incidentally, one of the other leading causes of death in the United States, which I think recently became like the public number one, other than the medical thing, which to kind of, you know, play that one down, is suicide. Number one cause of death in the United States is suicide. What does it say on all of them pharmaceutical drug packets as a possible side effect? Murder, suicide?
Yeah. It's happening quite a bit, actually. Antidepressants seem to have a depressing side effect in that it could cause you to kill yourself or others, or both.
Now, you see, I've seen a stoner murder a cheeseburger, but I've never seen him murder anybody else, unless he was on something else as well, maybe.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing in that a lot of these diseases, and we cover this in the film Drug Lord, in our segment on the comparative benefits and harms of drugs, where we compare cannabis to alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceuticals in terms of what their benefits are and what their harms are. And we show that the pharmaceuticals are very, very problematic for not only for their high propensity for addiction, but also because of unpredictable side effects. A lot of these drugs can and have quite frequently caused otherwise normal, passive, agreeable people into murderers. And entire families have been slain by people who've actually lost their minds because of antidepressants. So you then hold that up against cannabis, which is a proven antidepressant, and is also proven in treating PTSD, which is why antidepressants are often prescribed. Cannabis has never had that side effect. It's never had the side effect of causing someone to go into a murderous rage. And curiously, if you look at the history of cannabis, it was that lie which caused it to be illegal, that lie put forward in films like Reefer Madness, which, by the way, was sponsored by an alcohol distillery and some church groups. But an alcohol distillery put up the money to make the film Reefer Madness. So, you know, the alcohol industry was taking out a competitor. And alcohol is a drug that causes violence. That's demonstrable and has been proven time and time again. So the drug that doesn't cause harm was made illegal by presenting it as the drug that causes these harms, which are in actual fact caused by these other two drugs which are legally available and always have been.
And, of course, the manufacturers of those other drugs financed this defamation campaign in order to wipe out their competition.
Exactly. It's still happening today. You know, in terms of rectifying the drug laws, pharmaceutical companies are taking a direct role in retarding the process of reforming the drug laws. They have a lot at stake. If, for example, cannabis were legalized and you could grow and produce your own medicine for at least 100 ailments that cannabis has demonstrated can be helpful or even cure, then they lose that enormous swathe of people who would otherwise be dependent on chemical drugs that they cannot produce themselves. They can only be purchased from pharmacies or hospitals. So, you know, they will lose a massive share of their market, and they're holding on to that quite bitterly. And I'm sorry, there's one other thing I'd like to add there. They're also patenting cannabinoids as fast as they can so that they can hold the intellectual ownership of certain cannabis molecules. And the U.S. government itself owns one of these patents. So they're holding back the reforms to get as much of this intellectual property as they can under their own ownership.
So that in the future, you won't get handcuffed and arrested. You'll be served with a lawsuit for smoking weed without permission.
That's right, exactly. I mean, they want to own not just the cannabinoid molecules, but human DNA, all kinds of things like that that should not be owned. That's crossing a very dangerous line into the Philip K. Dick nightmare future. And, you know, it's very difficult to step back. And I'm hoping that people out there that are listening to this tonight are the open-minded people who can distinguish the truth from the enormous tsunami of lies that gets washed over them every single day. Yeah, man, it's real hard to keep your attention on what's true when there's so much stimulation of your brain through the media out there that focusing on what you need to do to fix shit now is really hard. And but I think people out there recognize the dangers that they have to face and to get through this dark time in human history.
This dark risen time. Now, there is a danger, of course.
Keep smiling.
That
keep smiling.
When you are exposing scumbaggery, sometimes you become the victim of it. You know, like, I don't know if you've had any brush-ins with the police in the course of making this film.
Oh,
that
yeah.
They have threatened you or something of that nature.
Well, no. Bullying and intimidation on a kind of low-key level, nothing really that I can complain about, but except for the time they confiscated my camera and hard drives and tapes, about 75 tapes. And they had to watch. I mean, think about how much that cost. Because the detective told me he watched every single when I went to the police station to make my statement, and I had to go back there about a year later when they turned over the tapes to me. He told me he watched them all. And there was about 75 hours worth of tapes and hundreds of hours on the hard drive. So that was how many tax dollars burned up just watching through these tapes to gather evidence from these tapes. You know, we're talking about thousands of dollars just on this one little segment of his investigation. Yeah, that's your tax dollars at work. Meanwhile, there's 5,000 burglaries, rapes, child beatings, hit and runs, assault with a bottle going on in New Zealand every single night. 200 assaults.
Yeah, but that's dangerous
200
stuff.
200 assaults.
The cops don't want to get involved in any kind of dangerous stuff that would be a danger to them. They want to pick on completely defenseless, innocent stoners because that's a good way to get the feather in the cap without getting your head blown off or your throat cut.
True. It's a lot easier. And it's also one of these crimes where it pops out at you and you know it's going to be an easy bust and you don't have to spend the night stopping real crime. You can just go back to the police station and write a report that you pulled somebody over and patted them down and found some utensil and Section 18 them, and you're going to get the same overtime. You know, you're going to get the same overtime as chasing down a burglar. Who wants to chase down a burglar? You know, they don't have enough donut shops in New Zealand, because then at least cops would have something to do rather than chase after potheads. They could just go and have a donut. And, you know, in fact, though, that's, you know, I want to retract that statement, because New Zealand police, you guys are in good shape. I don't see any slouches on the New Zealand police force. You guys work hard. So I'm taking back the donut comment.
The New Zealand police actually passed, I think, Judith Collins, or as I like to call her, Crusher Collins, I believe.
GDC.
Actually passed some kind of regulation that the police actually have to be in good physical shape in order to, you know, pull duty kind of thing.
Oh, no, that's good. That's good. I mean, they look in trim. I'm happy with that.
She also, at the same time, passed a law that means if you hit a police officer, even when they're not on duty, it still counts as hitting a police officer.
Oh, wow. So that's cool. She's, you know, she's quite a mean person. I'd like to talk about how she features in our film, Drug Lord. And incidentally, listeners out there, if you'd like to pre-order the DVD at Kickstarter, just go to druglord.com and click on the Kickstarter link. But Judith Collins features in the documentary Drug Lord, and under her auspicious leadership, the prison population in New Zealand has swelled to a record high. And they're now building, to accommodate these this excess of prisoners, 700 of whom, incidentally, out of a population of about 7,000, so just almost 10%, it's actually 9%, of prisoners are there for cannabis-only offences. So it's a significant portion. They have never done anything else wrong. It's just been a cannabis bust. And that accounts for just 9%, or a whopping 9% of the prison population that Judith Collins lords over. She's quite proud of herself, and she wants to expand the privatization of New Zealand's prisons through the new Wiri prison in South Auckland, which they're building right now. And I think that's got 900 new beds. So that's if the statistics hold up, that will be about just under 90 cannabis only offenders will be warehoused in that lovely new facility. Now, Serco, the weapons manufacturer that is running Wiri Prison and is also running Mount Eden Prison in partnership with New Zealand's government, Serco has a very nebulous record of maintaining these facilities, and prisoners are often complaining about being underfed, underheated, not given the privileges that they've earned, not being supplied with toilet paper. I've heard from prisoners there that they don't have utensils in their cells, and so they have to fabricate a cup out of a milk carton. So even basic things, you know, that you need just to maintain some remnant of your human dignity are denied these people. And I don't think it's because they really want to torture the prisoners like they do in some prison facilities. I think it's just that they want to save dollars, so they cut costs wherever they can, and the prisoners are the ones who suffer as a result. And those people who invested in Serco are laughing all the way to the bank, because their share value goes up with every dollar that Serco saves on these people by stiffing them of toilet paper and food.
I think they even did that to Kim.com, bro.
Yeah, Kim.com actually was serving time in Mount Eden Prison at the same time as Dr. Green, who features in the movie Drug Lord that we're talking about. And I heard secondhand reports of Kim being in prison. Kim, I love you and I hate you. I love what you're doing for internet freedom. I think, though, that we need people of integrity leading the party that you represent now, and that's not you, Kim. So you build it and put somebody who's got the right stuff, you know, who carries the fire, who carries Jafire. Find that person, Kim. Put him in charge. Somebody who loves the earth. Somebody who loves the sky. You're not that guy, but you've got the money. So I'm your guy, Kim. Put me in charge, and Jafire will burn.
Something tells me that's not going to work out too well.
No. I met Kim's wife. I didn't meet Kim's wife. I slipped Kim's wife a note, actually, but it didn't go further than that. No, it wasn't call me. It said, get Kim to call me and we'll set up an interview. But no, it didn't happen. So, Kim, I'm still up for it. I'll make you famous.
You didn't give her a foot massage?
No, man. No foot massage. It was outside the courthouse. There was not time. And she was, you know, she was in a hurry too. So no time to massage my feet.
You don't want to be in that ballpark, eh?
No. But, Kim didn't want to... I think Kim has got a love-hate relationship with the press, people like you and me. I think you and me, our style of reportage is not going to fit in with his PR. But you never know, you know. You never know. We could one day find ourselves working for Kim.com.
I'll never work for anybody again. I'll work with people. I'll just never work for them.
Yeah, we'll work with you, Kim. We'll work with you.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is, Kim's a lot like me and you, is that we're all creative people and we're energetic and we're kind of innovative about those things that we're doing. To the point where we don't necessarily need to be in business with somebody else or need to work with somebody else in particular or whatever. It's just, if it works out, it works out, and it's good. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, everybody can have their disagreements about little things here or there, but at the end of the day, it's on the points that you agree upon that you should come together and collaborate, because those points that you disagree upon, not only could you argue with about them endlessly, but also at the same time, that'll distract you from the bunch of ruthless, criminal, sociopathic scumbaggery that are trying to exterminate you.
Yeah.
So I think maybe we can start disagreeing about stuff after we get rid of that little problem. You know, that's just me.
Yeah, no, systemic problems in terms of how people are governed. You know, it's intractable. You know, there's never. But the odd thing is that if I can digress to a supposedly utopian society that was set up in California during the 1960s, where they tried to, you know, have a society there that was not governed, and it actually broke down into chaos, you know, a situation where people were being hazed. There was hierarchies. There was abuse. There was all kinds of really strange human behaviors that developed in a situation where there was no governance. So, you know, hopefully in the last 40 years, we've learned a little bit more where we can create these utopian societies that don't break down. You know, I think the main problem now is keeping your utopian society afloat in the midst of economic collapse, because before the current financial system, you might have been able to set up something that was utopian, live off the land and through barter and so forth. But now, you know, the value of your goods is being devalued every second of the day, every time that debt clock turns over. You know, your ability to trade is diminished as well. So setting up these utopian societies is becoming really difficult. What we can be hopeful about, though, is that you can create a utopian society based entirely around hemp and cannabis, where the main product of your community, and it is an agrarian utopian community in this case, not an urban one, is producing fields of hemp, 50 hectares of hemp, and maybe a warehouse of medical cannabis for processing and sale to the market in a legally controlled market. And such a society is through the production of one single crop. Well, it's a diverse crop, but it's one single plant species. They can produce building materials, clothing materials, all kinds of textiles, substrates for processing things like dynamite, cellulose, plastics, bioplastics. You can produce food, milk, the highest grade oil for human consumption, hemp oil, fuel, biofuel, zero carbon emission fuel, all of these things from a single crop, right? That's a completely self-sufficient and prosperous business structure where your crop is very useful and very valuable, and is also very easy and cheap to produce and detoxifies the soil and has all of these other positive benefits environmentally. Takes a fraction of the resources to grow a plot of hemp than it does to grow wheat or any of these other foodstuffs. So that is a utopian society that's completely plausible. And the buildings can also be made from the cannabis that you're growing.
It's a utopian society. And incidentally, you know they're talking about skyscraper farms now, bro.
Mm.
Yeah,
I have heard about that.
I think that would be great. You wouldn't even use it. Like, you know the power structure, kind of like those massive towers or whatever in The Matrix?
Mm-hmm.
You know? You know, imagine that. Just a city in the middle of nowhere, just these skyscrapers just jutting up into the air and it all growing copious quantities of hemp.
I don't think hemp would grow well in that situation. Hemp needs sunlight. You wouldn't be growing hemp through electric lighting or indoors like that. But you could definitely grow, you know, tons and tons of high-grade medical cannabis that could be used to cure people of cancer, as is demonstrated in Rick Simpson's excellent film, where he cures, I don't know how many hundreds of people or dozens of people, just in that one film, people who testified that he completely cured them of otherwise terminal cancer. And I believe you had him on the show, yeah. So I mean, you could cure or make a very large dent in the world's burgeoning cancer rates by making cannabis farms and in these skyscrapers, and replacing pharmaceutical drugs as a cure for cancer.
You could call them high scrapers.
High scrapers. That's right. Because and furthermore, not only do you get the medical benefit out of the flowers, you know, whereas, you know, you're growing an opium poppy for its medicinal benefits, you're just taking one small part of the plant. The rest is waste material. With the cannabis plant, you're using the roots, you're using the stalk, you're using the leaves, if you choose to, you're using the seeds, and you're using the flowering tops. So every single part of that plant can actually be made into something useful and valuable, whereas other crops, wheat, corn, all of these things, most of the biomass that's growing out there on the field is actually a waste product, which is going to cost thousands and thousands of hours and millions of dollars and tons of fuel to get rid of. That problem doesn't exist when you're growing hemp. So that's another reason why these utopian, this vision of a utopian society that I project around hemp is completely plausible. The product itself has all the attributes for sustaining a farming community without any other crops involved. Food, fuel, fiber,
well,
medicine.
True, but people wouldn't want to only eat hemp all day, every day.
No, of course they wouldn't, although it is delicious. But you see, hemp can be processed into many different things. You know, it won't be, you know, just gruel, which incidentally was the main ingredient in hemp was the main ingredient in gruel. If you ever want to know what gruel is, it's actually mostly hemp seed. Tastes disgusting. It's hemp seed and water. But with modern cooking processes, you can turn that hemp seed and the hemp milk into a whole bunch of things that don't resemble the original ingredient at all, have wonderful taste, and are 100% vegan, super healthy. Super healthy. Hemp is declaratively the most nutritious plant on the planet. Yeah, you can live on hemp seeds and water.
Oh yeah, that's true. In fact, there was a community in Australia that had a drought or something like that, and all their crops failed except for the hemp, and they survived on the hemp. When was that?
No, I'm not too clear on the exact time, but it's the staple diet in Nepal. One must also recognize that these drug laws are not just a war on people for using drugs. It's just a war on people in general. It's a war on resources. The Nepalese food crops are wiped out, are eradicated as part of this drug war, because those food crops fall under the gamut of the UN's prohibitions. So you get people actually starving because their crops are wiped out by DEA agents and military operatives who are acting under the auspices of the UN and the United States.
I believe that's being called getting treated appallingly.
Yes. By the way, folks, you're at Vinnie Eastwood's show, so you're going to hear a lot of bad puns tonight.
I am the bad pun master, and I'm not proud of the title either.
Speaking of food eradication, it's not just in Nepal, it's also in India, where in the northern parts of India, ganja is grown as a food crop. It's one of the staples up there. And I'd like to also talk about ganja and that word and the roots of that word. if I could digress into
somebody
that.
Somebody asked me once, you know, Vinny, is there weed in India? And I go, of course there is, bro. Why the hell do you call that river the Ganges?
The Ganges River, the Ganga River, that word means cannabis. The Ganga River, the sacred river to, you know, the Hindus and hundreds of other religions that exist in the Indian subcontinent. That river is named the Cannabis River, if you were to actually translate it. And Shiva, one of their most important gods, is the god of cannabis, and is the sacrament of Shiva is ganja. So, you know, it's deeply rooted into that country's history. I mean, more deeply than any plant, really. Much more deeply than any other plant on the planet. And it's prohibited. So, you know, it's a very bizarre situation where a country, well, in this case it was because India was under the control of the colonial governments of governance of the same family that rules New Zealand, the English monarchy, were controlling India at that time, and they're the ones
the
that
Coburg Gotha.
Yeah, it goes back to the Germans. They're not even English, they're Germans. So because they had colonial authority in India, they made cannabis illegal, and this integral part of Indian life was made illegal from that time forward. So, you know, there are certain provinces in India where it's state regulated, the bung shops, but you know the productivity of the entire Indian agrarian sector was undercut massively by banning one of their most essential crops along with rice. So, you know, it's damage to their environment because of the alternative crops causing so many problems and using so much water compared to cannabis, which is very soft on the environment, is astronomical. And that's another one of these unwritten costs of the drug war. You know, it's an ecocidal program. And a little bit later, I'll tell you about the police action in around Gisborne with regards to cannabis eradication. It's a frightening story. Oh, okay. Well, I'll explain it now. So I met a grower who was quite big at that time, probably second biggest importer or provider of cannabis during that period is Mr. Asia. He knew Mr. Asia, but they were not partners, and he avoided Mr. Asia because he thought he was a psychopath. So this grower who I'm going to interview, and this is going to be in the extras of the DVD of Drug Lord for those of you who want to see his own testimony. He was growing in the forests around Gisborne, and he was living out there to protect his crop from the police and from patch pirates. And he'd become kind of like a wild man of the bush from living out there for so long. And he had thousands of plants out there. And he was watching this from the hill one day when he saw a convoy of police trucks arriving in the middle of the night. And there were about a dozen trucks or a dozen vehicles, including several trucks with cages, multiple cages stacked on the backs of these trucks. And 20 or so policemen jumped out of the vehicles and opened these cages and released full-grown possums into the forest with the intention that the possums would sniff out all the weed plants, which they really like to eat because they're such a nutritious source of food, not just for possums, but for many, many animals. But the possums, because they're particularly voracious, would sniff out all the crops in the forests and destroy them. And that is, in fact, what happened. And it was this police action which introduced possums into this region. There were no possums in this region before. So sorry to all the birds that got eaten and all their eggs that got eaten and all the other fauna and flora that was decimated in this invasion of full-grown possums that are probably still entrenched in that region outside Gisborne today. We applaud you, New Zealand police, making New Zealand safe.
You know, that's on a par with the Scotsman who said, hey, you know, it'd be a really good plant to introduce, you know, for hedges, some gorse. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's prickly,
yeah.
It grows everywhere, you can't stop it. It'll be great.
Great hedge material. Yeah, well, a lot of misguided things are happening. A lot of misguided things. I still see 1080 all over the place. There's this deadly poison that they want to drop. I'm sure the 1080 manufacturers are laughing about that.
Incidentally, you know how you're talking about the possums killing all the birds and everything like that?
Yeah.
Well, apparently there's no surveys to prove that claim. And there's no surveys of any TB analysis or anything of the entire population either. We're the only country in the world that drops 1080 and licenses it for outdoor use. We consume 95% of the world's supply of 1080 made by one company in the United States at $50 million a year.
Not even a New Zealand company that's benefiting from the poisoning
it kills
of
everything. It kills
New Zealand's
everything.
Rivers, it's a forests. What's this company called?
Oh, fucking if I know. I'll interview Clyde Graff. He made the movie called Poisoning Paradise, a really good film about 1080 there. It's on my YouTube channel, bro. I'll send you the link later on. But yeah, man, it's a total farce, you know, and they're just dropping 1080 in there. In my opinion, it's again the ecocide agenda. They want to kill everything that lives in that because why else would they use a substance which is a food chain poisoner? All right, bird eats it. It dies. Then a cat, then a feral cat or something like that eats the dead carcass of the bird. It dies. And then a couple of bugs come along to start eating the carcass of that cat. They die. Then a couple of birds come along to eat those bugs, and then it dies, and the cycle starts again. It's a circle of death.
Indeed, it's quite frightening. There's a book out now called The Sixth Extinction, which explains how the rate of dying off of species on this planet now has equaled the rate at which the fifth extinction reached, which was caused by an asteroid striking the Earth and blacking out the sun. So, you know, we're on par with blacking out the sun right now. I think the problem is that, you know, people are too distracted to focus on the problems and the severity of the problems. And they're just too gratified by all the cheap thrills that are thrown at them. I'm going to quote Nelson Mandela again soon, but you go ahead first.
I would say it's two words, bro. Learned helplessness.
Learned helplessness. There's entrenched laziness that helplessness and laziness, I guess they're the same thing. Because if you feel helpless, you're just too lazy to help yourself. And that's the state that this torpid state that humankind has entered into now in the age of mass media. And I want everybody out there to turn off their televisions. Turn off Game of Thrones is stupid. Turn off Game of Thrones now. Read a fucking book. Read the newspaper, not the New York Times. Or the Washington.
Go fly some predators or something.
Turn
you
off
know,
Fox
have, a,
News.
Have a game of drones.
Turn off
Obama
Fox News
will
now.
Hire you.
Start watching Russia Today. Start watching Al Jazeera. I know a lot of people in Mississippi and Alabama are going to hate the sound of that, and Al Jazeera is a swear word to you, and Russia Today sounds communist, but those are the only trustworthy news sources that I think are out there right now, so please turn off Fox News. Thank you. This was a public service announcement.
And notice he did not include the Vinny Eastwood Show in his only two lists of credible sources, which is actually accurate because I'm not credible, all right? I'm incredible.
You're incredible.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to get some water? Give me a two-second break, folks.
You know what? We actually have come to the 55-minute break for the second hour, so we are going to, but let's. I need to take a WikiLeak as well. We'll be right back, folks. it going, keep it going, he says. All right, well, the whole thing, I think, when it comes to understanding the mentality of the people that you're dealing with that are actually implementing all of these laws and everything like that, is basically that of a clinical psychopath. You know, it's not really arguable. Okay, they lie without even foreseeing the consequences of their actions. They never get brought to justice. They never feel any guilt. They never apologize. It's just the most ultimate form of scumbaggery imaginable, essentially. When it comes to scumbaggery, the government has got it locked down and key. It's actually quite beautiful. Because not only can they bring you into the world, educate you to believe that scumbaggery doesn't exist, but then they can use scumbaggery to educate you about how the scumbaggery doesn't exist. And so, as a result, if you grow up surrounded by scumbaggery, you never even notice it. Kind of like the same way somebody grows up on a pig farm and never, ever complains about the smell.
Yeah, people are conditioned into obedience very easily, in fact. I mean, there's the Stanley Milgram experiment, which showed that. And so Vinny's taking a break, and I'm taking over the show. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show, coming to you from Auckland, New Zealand, where Vinny Eastwood is railing against the system of dominance and oppression. And so am I, using my film Drug Lord as a means to educate the public about the drug wars, the drug war, and to help reform the drug laws that we currently have, make more sensible drug laws. And those of you who are in Auckland, who will be here on the 20th of March, you should make a stop at the Pathway to Reform conference, because some of the foremost experts in the world are coming to Auckland to talk about policy reforms and sensible drug laws that can return the drug problem to the public health sector, because currently it's handled by the criminal justice system, and that's just an appalling misuse of resources. If you have a couple of dollars that you'd like to bounce our way, please go to druglord.com and click on the link to our Kickstarter fundraiser page, which is the green link at the top right-hand corner of druglord.com. That's druglord, L-A-W-E-D, D-R-U-G-L-A-W-E-D.com. And help us finish post-production of this epic documentary. We've been working on this movie for 4 years. We've interviewed about 45 people so far. And we've taken about 25 of those interviews and edited a fantastic movie which covers the drug laws in detail and explains how New Zealand has been wrapped up in this drug war through coercion by the United States government. It's not just the drug war that New Zealand has followed the United States into. There's also the war on terror, which is something else which is equally nebulous. And I'm just going to go off on a little bit of a tangent to talk about that, because recently New Zealand has signed some legislation which allows the GCSB, New Zealand's version of the National Security Agency, to spy on the entire population pretty much at will. I mean, there are certain restrictions, but they are minor restrictions, and all the data that's being gathered is being gathered regardless of whether you like it or not. So they can have a look at that data, and who knows what might cause them to do so. You know, they might run an algorithm through your email and they see the word terrorism mentioned or bomb or something like that, and you might be a journalist who's writing about those issues. You get black flagged. And your freedom of speech is severely curtailed. Your freedom to travel may be curtailed. You might be stopped at an airport in the United States because the GCSB flagged you as somebody who might be a terrorist when you're actually a journalist and you're trying to expose the truth about the war on terror. Now you can't, because you've been silenced through the mechanisms of the war on terror. So it's it's like a Philip K. Dick nightmare future that we've inherited, all because of an incident back in 2001 where several buildings collapsed mysteriously. And, well, yeah, three buildings collapsed and one has a strange-shaped round hole in it that doesn't resemble the hole that a Boeing 747 would leave in a building. Yeah, and I wonder how many people out there. I've got Vinny's come back, and as I said, several buildings, he put up three fingers because there wasn't just World Trade Centers 1 and 2. There was World Trade Center 7, which a lot of people do not know about because it was not very widely reported that a third building, which was not struck by any airplanes, fell down all on its own, basically. It had some minor fires burning it, but the fire department had those fires under control when they were pulled out of the building, and the building crimped in the middle and collapsed in about 7.5 seconds, a 49-story skyscraper.
Which is equal to free fall speed, which means there was no resistance upon any of the falling debris in a steel-framed skyscraper, and it was the third steel-framed skyscraper in history to go down because of fire, and steel frame building has ever collapsed due to fire before or since 9/11.
Correct. All three on one day. Isn't that odd? Architectural failure of epic proportions then. But the Japanese architect who designed the Twin Towers came out and said that this is highly unlikely that a plane caused this because they were purpose-built to resist that eventuality. And I find it interesting that the entire buildings from basement to ceiling to the top floor were basically a poisonous hazard with hundreds of tons of asbestos that needed to be removed, and that would have cost quite a lot of money to.
In fact, a friend of mine's sister runs like Nikkei Contracting,
yeah.
And they actually got called into the World Trade Center in 2001 to do a bid on the removal contract of all the asbestos. And they went in and go, "Wow, that's a huge job, man! This is multi-$1 million. Can't you think of anything cheaper to do than manually remove the asbestos?" And they said, "Well, we wanted to try controlled demolition, but the EPA said we wouldn't be able to because all of the asbestos dust would
kill all the first responders, American heroes left to die by their healthcare system." And I've got nothing against Obamacare. I've got something against the American government and anything that it's purports is going to help people. It's all a joke. It doesn't really matter if you're from a red state or a blue state. It's all just one purple mess. And so those first responders now have been left out in the cold because they can save money by letting them die, essentially. So that's how your government treats your American heroes.
That's how your government treats eyewitnesses.
Oh, eyewitnesses as well, exactly. You know, there's been a lot of mysterious deaths, not just related to 9/11 witnesses, but more recently there's been a whole spate of mysterious deaths. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman might be one of them. You know, it's a case of you as an opponent of the state can actually just be taken out the same way that a mafia boss will take out a reporter who's getting too close to the truth. You know, I don't think that'll ever happen to you or me. I don't think we'll ever be significant enough on the world stage to warrant an assassination attempt. But, you know, I live in hope. Come get me, Johnny K. Come get me, Johnny K.
All it takes is the right price, you know. You gotta bribe them politicians just right, you know, just right, the way that they like it, you know. You gotta have some nice girls, some beautiful champagne. You gotta wine them, you gotta dine them.
Oh yeah, and then
you can steal every dime from them.
Yep, gangster governments everywhere. You know, there's only one government in the world that I trust. I'm not saying there's only one trustworthy government, but the only one that I know about is Uruguay and Jose Mujica. You are doing what every president or leader in this world should be doing, that being thinking about the people who you are serving, not ruling. And that's what Jose Mujica is doing. He's serving the people, not ruling the people.
Well, let's hope he doesn't get assassinated by some kind of US CIA hit squad or something like that. So you want to do this? No way, Jose.
They did it to Lumumba. They did it to, you know, they've done it thousands of times. They did it to, you know, just about half of South America has had their leader assassinated, their democratically leader assassinated or deposed in a CIA-instigated coup. So, you know, it wouldn't be beyond the spectrum of what they might be considering now. But I know that Jose Mujica has definitely displeased the establishment, particularly the UN drugs controls agencies, by dismissing the UN International Convention on Drugs. He's basically said, nah, we signed it, but I don't care anymore, which is exactly what he should say, because it's outdated. It was crafted in the 1940s and 50s, you know, and we're now in 2014. You know, why are we living under a regime that was crafted during World War II? That's when the drug regime that we currently have was drafted. So it's retarded, and I don't want to use that word offensively. I want to use that word accurately. It is a retarded thing to be doing. We are slowing ourselves down in the most horrendous and costly way.
Well, of course, everybody says, oh, well, what can I do about it? What can I do about it? As if it's a rhetorical question. It doesn't need an answer. Hey, look. Not everybody's issue is cannabis. All right, I accept that. I did hardcore cannabis activism involved with the same daiquiri people and Dr. Green like you were for a number of years, I think. And, you know, you go and you look up daiquiri on YouTube, guess who's got all the videos there? It's freaking me.
It's Vinny Eastwood.
Yeah, I've done heaps.
We were comparing numbers earlier, listeners at home. But I still maintain that 420 New Zealand is New Zealand's dedicated cannabis channel. So, folks, subscribe to 420 New Zealand. Mm-hmm. It's all one word. All my videos are made by me. And the one that was posted yesterday relates to the Pathway to Reform conference, which is happening on the 20th of March. And we've got a screen behind us, folks. And if you don't mind, we'd like to play this video for you. And you'll be able to hear Grant Hall talk about the lineup of people who are about to come to New Zealand to deliver the goods about why the drug war is such an epic failure and how New Zealand can lead the global community into putting drug control back into the public health sector instead of where it is now, the criminal justice sector, which is causing all these problems. So I'm going to roll Grant Hall's promotion of Pathway to Reform.
Hi, my name is Grant Hall from the Star Trust, and I want you to know how excited I am about this event happening March the 20th here in Auckland at the Nathan Club. Now, we've got some of the world's foremost experts coming to New Zealand to share their wisdom with us. They want to know how we're going with our new policy innovation that will regulate scientifically proven low-risk social tonics and then have them distributed through a licensed retail channel. That solution, that approach, which has never ever been done anywhere in the world before, is why we have so much interest and so much focus on New Zealand right now. This event on March the 20th is going to set the narrative. It's going to set the tone for all the debate around this in and during this election year. It's a very, very important event. I hope to see you there. If I don't, then please tune into the live stream, because we're letting everyone participate in the conversation. We've got a hashtag Pathway to Reform. You can get involved through social media. You can be engaged in some of the panel discussions. It's going to be an amazing day. Thank you very much for your interest and participation. See you on March the 20th.
And thank you to the Star Trust and Grind Hall, who have been supporting the production of Drug Lord. For those of you who are watching the podcast, you see this graphic behind me. The poster was sponsored by the Star Trust. They had a designer come up with that, and this T-shirt as well. The merchandising that you can get at our Kickstarter page, which you can find by going to druglawed.com, druglawed.com, and clicking on the green Kickstarter link.
Yes, it's a worthy cause indeed. And here's the other problem as well. It hopefully might do. Like, we've talked about a number of different topics on this show tonight, you know, pharmaceutical industry, 9/11, and all of this other kind of jazz, right? Well, everything's connected by the thinnest of strands, but that thin strand is a strong link indeed, if it's a freaking unbreakable strand of truth, it is. And at the end of the day, any conspiracy that you start to realize, start to accept, can start to make you think about other things that are connected. And hopefully, watching the film Drug Lord will, in fact, enable people to understand some of the geopolitical scumbaggery that is going on around the issue, as well as link it up to a whole bunch of more ones. But
yep. Yeah. As you say, Vinny, everything is connected. There are multiple strands that are interwoven here. You know, we've talked about them earlier. We talked about the prison industrial complex, military industrial complex, which is subcontracting the slave labor of the prisons out to make weapons, you know, bombs and so forth. We talked about that in the first segment of the show. Those prisoners are there because of the drug war. A lot of them are black. A lot of them were arrested on minor drug charges. They got massive sentences because they're the wrong color and lived on the wrong side of the tracks, you know. Nobody's going to throw Will Smith in jail, Will Smith's kid in jail, when he gets caught with a bong. You know, there's one law for the rich.
They did throw Wesley Snipes in jail. But
Snipes was in jail for tax evasion. That's something different. That's dissing the Fed. That won't stand. That will not stand. Snipes, word out to Snipes. Yeah. Remember, you were a taekwondo champion. You can fight off those rapists in prison. You can fight them off. When you're out, you'll be back on top.
I always thought that Wesley Snipes would like be like at prison. Do you remember when he played, what was his name, Simon Phoenix in Demolition Man, where he's like this king criminal, and he gets all these other really nasty, nasty criminals unfrozen with him and stuff? You know, I reckon it'd be like that. You know, Wesley Snipes walks out of the joint and he's like head honcho.
Do you know what? I think Wes is probably the man in jail. I think Wes is like Mike Tyson in jail. He's still got his celebrity status, because all those guys in jail worship celebrities just as much as all the people outside of jail. They've all got the same programming. So, you know, Wes, if you're in jail, you know, live it up. You're still a celeb. That'll never change. Look at Lindsay Lohan.
Is Wesley Snipes still in jail? When did he go?
I don't know. You know, do we have internet access? Can we digress to find out if Wesley's out of jail?
Well, I think this is probably the most important part of the show. Is Wesley Snipes still in jail?
Okay, now I just want people to understand, we're talking about the Federal Reserve Bank, which is actually behind Wesley Snipes being in jail, because Wesley Snipes refused to pay his income tax, which you don't have to pay.
Here we are.
Find the law that says you have to pay income tax, stupid American.
April the 8th.
Stupid American, find the law. When you can't find it, stop paying income tax.
Yeah.
Okay, there's Wesley. Wesley was released in... Snipes is out of prison, and Sylvester Stallone has a role in The Expendables for him. Well, you should go back to prison, Wesley, because you shouldn't be starring in any action movies with Sylvester Stallone. Okay, he's over the hill.
I don't know.
It's bad for your career.
Look. I'm going to have to take issue with that last statement. The Expendables 2 was awesome because of Chuck Norris.
I didn't see Expendables 2, but I'm prepared to watch further Expendables sequence in the hope that one of those bastards dies on screen. Like,
it's,
for real.
It's mostly
not
in the
like,
hopes
not
that
like
you
a stunt that he actually dies. I hope it's Arnold.
It'll mostly be the reason why I thought it was really great is because of the one-liners, bro. The one-liners, there's just so many of them. If all of these action heroes have got their one-liners and everything, and what they do in the Expendables is they just recite one-liners virtually the whole time. It's freaking hilarious.
Okay, so it's basically a script of one-liners. They just coagulated all of those unused one-liners from the last 50 action movies into one script, and they just stuffed them all in there to make 2 hours of one-liner cap-off series, cap-off scenes. Okay.
With almost as many bad jokes now as Batman and Robin.
Batman and Robin. Was that the Joel Schumacher version?
It was so terrible, bro. Like,
it was awful. Oh, my God. Every movie ever made by him is horrible, but movies made by me are tremendous. So go to druglord.com, druglawed.com, to watch the trailer of the forthcoming release, Drug Lord, which exposes the drug war in all its many multifarious facets.
Yeah, that's right. Fuck you, Schumacher.
Yeah, man, forget about Schumacher.
I think we're probably getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. You know, we're just like commenting on celebrities while criticizing the general population for deifying them and all of that kind of thing. I mean, we're a bit hypocritical here.
I don't think so. I watched a recent documentary release called Propaganda, made by a New Zealander from Christchurch, Slavko. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. Slavko Miskov. I'll have to check on that. But anyway, Slavko turned around a really brilliant piece of filmmaking. It's actually a mockumentary. So it's presented as a release by the North Korean government critiquing the excesses of consumption in the West as a state-made propaganda piece. But of course, it's actually Slavko's direction that gives the story its shape. And it sounds like a North Korean propaganda piece, and it has been confused as being a genuine propaganda piece, but it's actually a very clever critique about how out of control the West's capitalistic system has become.
So what was that you call it? A genuine propaganda piece it was mistaken for. Can propaganda be genuine?
Yeah. I mean, the lines get very blurred. It is a propaganda piece, but it's a propaganda piece about, dethroning propaganda and dethroning celebrity. So, propaganda doesn't necessarily have to be false. You get good propaganda and bad propaganda. Good propaganda, for example, let's save what's left of the environment. I know a lot of people disagree about climate change, but let's just talk about pollution. You know, pollution is bad. Forget about the argument about climate change. There's too much pollution. We don't have to argue about climate change. We have to reduce pollution. It doesn't really matter if it's causing climate change. It's definitely causing the acidification of the ocean. That's a bad thing. If our coral reefs die, we all die because there'll be no fish in the oceans and there'll be no food for all the coastal areas that depend on the oceans for their food. That means those coastal people will invade the inlands and scarce resources will then be fought over and our entire world would degenerate into anarchy, war, famine, and chaos. So let's avoid that by living better today.
Yeah. And executing you for Rockefellers.
Well, I don't think these people should be executed because I don't believe in capital punishment. I believe they should be
excommunicated.
to like the moon. The idea of corporal punishment for really evil people, I think, is less punitive than imprisoning them for the rest of their lives and letting them stew. I think people who want revenge through corporate punishment have actually missed the opportunity to really make somebody's life unbearable just through boredom, if not through other means. I've been confined for 30 days. It's very taxing. It's taxing.
You know what? Actually, David Rockefeller will become a very popular person in prison. He'll be welcomed like a prince of darkness.
How old is Rockefeller? He must be in his 80s
now. 90s, bro. 90s. It must be like Kissinger.
90s. Incredible. It's funny that that these dudes who've had such high-stress lives live for so long a lot of the time. Like Robert Mugabe, what keeps these people alive?
In a word, pedophilia.
You reckon they live just to defile...
No. It's because they defile them that they live. It's a different
really? Thing. Like vampires, they draw their energy from innocent...
It's dark occulted mysticism, bro.
I don't know if Mugabe is into witchcraft, but... I have heard that... I think it's almost certain that Kissinger was at coven meetings in the Redwoods in California... And they burned effigies and so forth. And I've seen the videos that were taped of the Skull and Bones Club, which Bush and Kerry and many other presidents and presidential candidates are members of. That was quite a gruesome ritual that was filmed from the rooftop of a neighboring building in the university campus. You couldn't clearly make out what was happening, but it looked quite demonic. So... whether or not they're just enacting some ritual, some kind of hazing, even if it is a hazing ritual, it's quite a nebulous ritual. And you've got to ask who would participate in that stuff, because if it was me in that coffin being screamed abuse at, I would say, excuse me, I'm leaving now, and I would leave. But of course, Bush and Kerry and et al., they endured that strange ritual to become members of this secret society. And that gives one pause for thought. If your leaders, if your national leaders are involved in a cult, you are in trouble. And it's not an if, they are. Well, Obama's not, but Bush definitely was a cult member. So, good luck.
Well, it's an old story, but it's a good story about the people who are in so much of a position of wealth and power.
Jeb Bush, 2016.
Well, the wealth and power is a corrupting thing. You know, it happens to everybody. And when you are capable of getting away with anything, literally any kind of debauched act you could possibly think of, Daddy will cover it up, etc. Imagine how insane that would drive you. Imagine what that would do to your desires, your humanity, and all of these things. You know, that's what happens.
I've met traders who've told me that the wolf on Wall Street is quite accurate, that it's not even over the top in terms of what they depict. And that sort of psychopathy gets replicated throughout many power structures, and the church and government have colluded in mass child abuse rackets that were suppressed. There's a very interesting documentary about that was made by an English channel and that was completely retracted that you can see online, which documents how the cabal of Republican congressmen and senators had conscripted a male prostitute and child slave ring into their personal use that was being run under the auspices of a church charity. So they were actually guilty of all kinds of heinous acts, and none of them were ever held accountable for these things, even though this documentary proved beyond doubt that there was this mass child abuse going on. They're beyond power. They're beyond the reach of the law because of the power that they have.
And they often come down on those who have actually personally experienced it and been right in the middle of
the
that kind of thing.
The victim becomes the perpetrator. And many of the people who brought charges against this cabal of Republican pedophiles and rapists were themselves destroyed in terms of, they were vilified, they were presented as liars and as extortionists. Meanwhile, they were just fighting for some minor compensation compared to what they'd undergone over years of abuse, systematic abuse and slavery, actually, I can check online for the name of this documentary. It'll pop back in my head, but it's terrifying. And currently, the kinds of abuses that are going on, I think they've gotten the pedophilia rings under control within the Republican Democrat dual dictatorship. But now,
do you mean by in better control, they're now able to cover them up cover a hell of a lot more. Better?
Well, we don't hear about it as much. but in terms of the incursions of the weapons and the military industrial complex into the government, it's quite incredible that a director of Raytheon, the company that produces smart bombs amongst other weapon systems, their vice president is Obama's one of his chief advisors, I think, to Obama is this Raytheon vice president. So if the guy who's making the bombs is advising the president, he's probably advising him to drop those bombs and on as many people as the president can get away with bombing. That's just the way Western style capitalism profits. So it doesn't matter what the product is, it has to go off the shelves, it has an expiry date, and Raytheon needs to produce new and smarter bombs to drop on brown people and black people. Not so much black people, the black people aren't getting bombed anymore, but a lot of brown people are getting it from Raytheon. Although, no, that's actually not true, because you've got the Congo and Central Africa. No, black people are also getting bombed. But it's more limpet mines than smart bombs. It's more paramilitary-style weaponization of Africa. But
Well, and then, of course, there's the Israelis to talk about in Palestine.
Oh, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm classing the brown people as, you know, the Arabs, the South Americans, and the black people, specifically the Africans. But, yeah, you know, you white people need to be careful, because it's only a matter of time. They're going to run out of people of color to bomb, and then they're going to bomb white people. That's going to be a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, it's kind of started to happen. But it's, it's going to happen more. It's not just going to be, you know, the former Yugoslavia. It's going to be bombs dropping in civilized Europe, you know. It's going to be bombs dropping soon. Because the bombs have been made, and that means they have to be used.
Isn't it interesting how you would, let's say, stack poison or weapons and what have you, and they've got to use by date? So it's like, oh my God, I have to kill somebody.
You can't. You know. I was talking to Vinny earlier before the show about the weaponization of ecstasy and during the apartheid years by the apartheid government in South Africa, where Wouter Besson made an aerosol ecstasy for crowd control, which was, you know, going to be blasted at the crowd using water cannons, this ecstasy dust, to basically pacify a crowd in the event of a riot. And they sold a lot of this ecstasy on the black market, tons of it. I don't know if you could say tons of it, but hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of ecstasy tablets were sold by Wouter Besson. And many barrels of the stuff, and a barrel would contain 50,000 tablets, were dumped in the ocean to dispose of the evidence of this crime, basically this weaponized ecstasy. And they weren't just weaponizing ecstasy, they were weaponizing a whole bunch of chemicals for use in crowd control, for use in interrogations, for use in all kinds of nebulous acts. And so I just wonder how many fish and other aquatic creatures were poisoned in the mass dumping of ecstasy and other drugs into the ocean to dispose of these state drug crimes, you know, that were perpetrated during South Africa during the apartheid years. You know, the costs of the drug war are insane, because Wouter Besson wouldn't have been able to do this in a regulated market. It was only because he could make so much money for his other off-the-books activities that he went into the ecstasy business and decided to weaponize ecstasy. It was a perfect opportunity. If you could purchase ecstasy legally, Wouter Besson wouldn't have done this. There wouldn't have been much point. Or there certainly would have been less profit to incentivize him to weaponize ecstasy.
I was told the creation story of ecstasy. Apparently, you know how everybody calls it E, right? Apparently that originally stood for empathy, not ecstasy.
And
they prescribed it for family violence or something like that. I mean, like,
yeah, it was a pharmaceutical augmentation of the psychiatric process, and it was being used extremely well. It had incredible results during the time when it was still legally available, and then it became a party drug, and it was in Texas where the first laws against ecstasy were drafted. Because it didn't fit in with the ruling agenda's idea of what a drug should do and the psychological states that a drug should produce. The drugs of preference in the Western world, which is now just about everywhere, the Western demagogy is spread everywhere, is that drugs that help you produce goods and be a good worker, such as caffeine and tobacco, those are the drugs that need to be legally available and which are in every country on earth. the ones that keep you productive, if I can use that word liberally, because you're not producing, you're obeying. Unless you're actually producing, I'm not talking about everybody who's listening to the show, and many of you might actually be creators rather than producers, and in which case, go ahead and be creative. But most people are just being productive within the economic system of producing basically goods of little value to be traded to bolster supposed economic growth and keep it high, which is impossible. So I advise people to use drugs that help them break out of that cycle, get away from caffeine if you can, or use it in moderation because it's quite a powerful drug. The U.S. Air Force uses it to keep their pilots alert when they're flying missions and delivering nuclear payloads from one silo to another. So it's a very powerful drug, and its use is to keep people alert and working. Use it less. Use these other drugs, like, for example, Carver calms you down, gives you nice dreams, and it's legal. So you don't necessarily have to break the law to find these other mind-altering substances that break you out of the kind of cage of your legal choice of pharmaceuticals, tobacco, caffeine, and alcohol. That's your little legal box, those four. And, you know, I advise people to break out of that square box and, you know, round out your world, round out your psychological experience on this earth by seeking these altered states of consciousness with drugs that enlighten and free you of the box mentality.
Humanity's been taking drugs since forever.
Dawn of time.
You know, I mean, if anything, I credit drugs with base principle frickin' growth.
The development
in humanity's,
of the outer cortex.
In humanity's, like, evolution kind
exactly.
of thing. As well as... also, apparently, cannabinoids, endocannabinoids, you might want to think about interviewing Dr. Bob Malamed about this, bro.
When will he be here?
He won't be here.
Oh,
he'll be on Skype, yeah. But anyway.
Good man.
Yeah, yeah. You've heard of Dr. Bob Malamed. Do you know what he's doing?
He's been in many of my favorite movies.
Yeah. So, you know, you might know him just as well as I do. But, yeah, endocannabinoids, ladies and gentlemen, cannabinoids from within. They build everything in your body. Everything.
If you didn't have them, you would be dead, and that's the exact same molecule that the cannabis plant naturally produces.
And isn't that the same molecule that these motherfuckers are trying to patent?
That is correct. So, well, there are 60 known, possibly more now, variations on the cannabinoid molecule. So they are patenting specific variations for use in specific medical conditions, whilst at the same time denying that cannabis has any medical benefit, thereby enabling them to schedule one it in their drug control regimen. So it's just, you know, with one side of their mouth they're saying no medical benefits, with the other side of their mouth they're talking to their patent lawyers to make sure that you cannot use that particular molecule for your own benefit without going through them and paying them a tribute.
Hold on a second. We own this molecule that has no benefit. So if you want any benefit from it, you can't have it yourself. You've got to come and pay us in order to give you the benefit from this molecule, which has no benefit.
Exactly.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
And you know the applications they're only just starting. We have David Nutt commenting on our in our medical segment about the fact that the cannabis plant has more medical applications than any other plant, and that there's an entire tranche of research that has been suppressed, never got done, was never authorized. They wouldn't supply the substrates to conduct the experimentation and the investigation into all the medical benefits that are still to be discovered. Because the cannabis plant was illegal, it was to do these experiments for the last 40 years, that's one of the greatest tragedies of all, because there would be hundreds of diseases out there that we would have cured, or we would know that cannabis can provide palliative care for these diseases, had we been allowed, or had the scientific world been allowed to conduct the research. Another cost of the drug war.
That's if you're keen on not enduring huge quantities of human suffering and profiting greatly by it.
True, true. While we're talking about endocannabinoids, and Vinny, you mentioned that they're one of the substrates to build your body and to actually keep your genes healthy and functioning. Your cells healthy and functioning. Endocannabinoids are present in your mother's milk. They are in breast milk, and they are there because one of the side effects of ingesting cannabinoids is that it stimulates appetite. So the little baby is getting a natural dose through the breast milk to stimulate his or her appetite, to encourage her to eat the breast milk to grow healthy and strong. So, you know, the idea that this molecule can damage a child's brain needs to be investigated seriously, because if it could, why over the millions of years that we've evolved, and primates have the same mechanisms as well in their breast milk, are we feeding our tiny infant tots it naturally? So during that stage of the brain development, it's probably a necessary part of growing up and Here's the irony. A woman in, I think, New Plymouth was found guilty of child abuse because they detected breast milk with cannabinoids in it and charged her for intoxicating her child. And this woman didn't go on the internet for 5 minutes, or her lawyer didn't go on the internet to find out that the charges are themselves completely bogus, because even if she had never smoked any cannabis in her life, cannabinoids would naturally be present in her breast milk. So the charges are basically fabricated. Probably she was smoking cannabis, and probably she might not have been the greatest mother. And I don't know her. Don't know the case in too many details. Maybe she was doing something else, and the authorities wanted to book her on something, and they used this as an excuse. But Mother Nature would have laughed at this. If Mother Nature, you know, had been consulted, this would have been thrown out of court immediately, because every mother on this planet has given cannabinoids to her child if she breastfed.
Well, that actually does beg the question. Is smoking weed and breastfeeding your child a good idea?
They did a study in Jamaica to show that it doesn't really have a high impact.
Of course they do, if it was done in Jamaica. How did I know that?
I don't buy that. I don't think it's advisable. And I think that people should have more respect for their unborn child to take a chance. So, but we know, though, that the effects of alcohol on the unborn fetus and the effects of cigarettes are traumatic. If there are effects from cannabis, they are less obvious. So, but don't take the chance, you know. So what if the research hasn't been done? If you are pregnant, don't ingest anything. Don't ingest coffee. Don't ingest any drug. It's possibly going to harm your child, so don't do it.
I think that's fair enough. But then again, I've heard a lot of other studies as well coming out that are saying that there's these thresholds or something like that.
Yeah.
That there's small quantities of usage. Say, like, for example, a pregnant woman can get away with like a glass of wine, per night or something like that in order to be. And then everybody's really kind of like thinking everything's really soft and squishy, but
the body's
really, really good at making stuff safe once it's ingested to a large degree.
To a large degree. Well, take the old a glass of wine if you're pregnant theory. Alcohol is toxic to every cell that it comes into contact with. So some of that alcohol is going to come into contact with your baby's little brain. That's for sure. It's not all going to get filtered out by your liver. Some of it's going to make it to your baby's brain. What quantities are acceptable? I'd say you don't want to take a chance. So even though I've never been pregnant, I wouldn't take that chance, and it's unlikely that I ever will. But it's not something that you should do. Don't drink at all. Think about your child, respect your unborn child, and don't take any drugs. And I know that might be hard, and if you're going to have a chocolate now and then, it's got caffeine, and yeah, okay, that's okay. And, you know, maybe a glass of wine every now and then is okay, but, like, respect the unborn.
In that case,
respect the unborn.
When it comes to smoking weed, how young is too young?
I would say a safe benchmark is 20. And I discourage teenagers from ever trying it, although they will. And should they do so, they should receive honest education about the risks and how to reduce the harms and how to not use it repeatedly, because I have met people who do use it too much, and there are impacts on them in later life. And those can be obviated by regulation. You know, those can be reduced through sensible policy. The Just Say No approach that Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan gave us. Yeah, you know, they can't even keep a zero policy within their own families. You know, the Bush zero policy within their own families. The Bush sisters are known to use pot. You know, so George Bush's own daughters, drug warrior George Bush, his own daughters don't respect his prohibition.
Probably because they know he worked for the CIA and was instrumental in bringing in most of the harder drugs.
Yeah, so comparatively, you know, what's a joint or two on a Saturday night? Yeah, you know, but Bush himself was himself a user, not just of, speaking of hard drugs, not just of marijuana and alcohol, but of cocaine. But he was young. I was young. And folks at home, that means that what I did back then when I was avoiding the Vietnam War is okay, because it was the 70s.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the 70s, the only decade known to man from which all behavior during that decade is excusable, because it was that decade.
It was the 70s.
You napalm people, bro. It was the 70s.
It was the 70s. Yeah, you know, the 70s were a very permissive era, permissive of genocide, permissive of illegal wars, permissive of, you know, all kinds of things that... human trafficking that were being conducted in the name of democracy. Mm-hmm. So it's all mighty righty and whitey and tidy.
Yeah. Well, it's just a global takeover. I mean, look, if anybody's got any freaking illusions, okay, there absolutely positively is a group of people who run the world, who run your life, who freaking own you like cattle and slaves and scum.
They changed. Yeah. This group is malleable. It's not like one cabal, you know. It's I think people believe that it's like always one group, but it's groups vying for dominance within the upper tiers of the hierarchy, you know.
Like what Ian Wishart's got to say about this. He says it's not conspiracy theory, it's convergence theory. Much like a shark attack, each shark has its own motivation, but they all got the same target. You.
Exactly, exactly. Yep, sharks are deadly predators. I think that the way that these cold-blooded psychopaths operate is quite shark-like, in that a shark is driven basically by one thing. Hunger. And in the case of a shark, it's hunger for meat or anything that it can digest. And in the case of our political elite, it's hunger for power. And it's an out of control system. You know, how humankind now has the technology for direct democracy. We have the internet. We have instant communication. We could actually be instituting a democratic system, a truly democratic system that's not dependent on voting. You're voting for a thing, an issue, an action, rather than a person who is then going to vote for the issue, and you have no control over how they actually vote on the day when the issue is brought forward in your parliament or wherever these laws are, these actions are decided. Direct democracy through the internet, through other instant communication media, is completely achievable right now. It's merely the case that the ruling elite will never allow that system to be instituted or even tested, because once it is tested, it'll be so obviously more successful than the current way that we rule our countries. It'll replace the traditional system of governance within years.
It worked in the Solomon Islands, I think, and I think their government was set up by large part by a New Zealander called Calvin Alp. And then, of course, the Solomon Islands got invaded by people who were funded by the New World Order. It's just, you know.
Don't tell me more. I don't know about the Solomon Islands issue.
Okay. You know, you pay a credit card in New Zealand, you know, 22%. The Solomon Islands, you can get 12% because they kicked the banksters out. All right. You know, they basically sussed it. And then they had all these gold mines and everything there, you know, lots of reserves, lots of money, all of that sort of stuff, totally self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, because they were having such successful workings with their direct democracy party, which got elected to power not too long ago, I think. Well, yeah, sets off a bad example.
I don't have that. Yeah, well, you find that almost all governance, excluding Uruguay and some other fortunate countries, is based on economic growth. So as soon as the Solomon Islands decided to opt out of that system of supposed economic growth, they just hung a target on their backs. And it doesn't take long for the IMF or the World Bank or the IMO, the International Monetary Fund, to exert control over whatever it is that you're trying to achieve there and institute an agenda that suits them. And yeah, you know, like we're talking about who controls this planet. You know, they all these bodies are themselves cooperating and competing. At any given moment, their allegiances can change. And you know, as those allegiances change, all kinds of geopolitical fallout just happens in the wake of those changes, you know. And who they are, like, if I can identify some of the main ones, the Catholic Church is one of the main ones, well, specifically the papacy. The Federal Reserve Bank is a huge one. The World Bank and all of the affiliates to the World Bank. The UN. Sometimes they're the Chinese government. Sometimes they're working in collusion, and sometimes they're competing. And, you know, we as people on the street really don't know what they're deciding behind closed doors. The Bilderbergers, now it's out pretty much in the open that there is this cabal. Each of the members of the Bilderbergers is affiliated to another organization or multiple organizations in the background. So, you know, it's like Game of Thrones, but it's really happening, and they don't have magic, they have technology, which is the same as magic at the level at which they're using it.
And they've got it in throes, you know, and even worse than that, they've got scumbaggery.
They do. They have that on their side. The Machiavellian philosophy has proved to be extremely useful in the ascension to power and the winning of wars. And it doesn't say be a nice person and share. It says steal and lie and kill, poison your enemies, and pillage their wealth. That's essentially what humankind's ruling elite has been doing for the last several thousand years.
That said, even though there's a system that's attacking everybody from every single direction, doesn't mean it's not a system that has everybody, one of us, attacking it from every single direction.
No, no, no. Distraction and diversion are a key system, are key parts of the system of control. If you can confuse the person who you're exploiting or subjugating into thinking that you are not his enemy, but somebody else who is your enemy is that person's enemy, then you can use that person's energies to destroy your own enemy whilst stepping back and allowing the process to happen. All you need to do is to miseducate both parties. And yeah, we find that happening. I mean, that's been a system of colonial control since day one, for example, in Rwanda, where the Belgians miseducated the Hutus and the Tutsis into thinking that they were historically a master-servant. They held a master-servant relationship historically, which they never did. They coexisted, and the Hutus were turned into the clerics of the Belgian colonial government. And as soon as the colonial government was deposed, the Hutus had built up such an entrenched hatred of their former brothers, the Tutsis, that they cut off their arms and legs and heads and mutilated them with pangas in the world's most atrocious genocide since World War II. So you know, that's how you use the people you're subjugating to do your bidding and destroy each
also,
other rather than destroy you.
Also one of the cheapest genocides
cheapest?
Ever. 10-cent machetes, bro. No bullets, no nukes, no
provided
nothing.
By,
just chop the
provided
hell out
by
of
the Belgian government. And the CIA had a part in the execution of Lumumba, who was seen as a communist sympathizer. So the democratically elected government of Patrice Lumumba was deposed through the CIA-backed assassination, and Lumumba was hacked to death and his body burned and tortured before they killed him. So, you know, the legacy of these coups and overthrows is still with us today. You know, Africa is a complete mess because when the colonial governments finally gave up direct control, they instigated puppet governments through all these tin pot dictators and continued to plunder those countries for their wealth, and they still do to this day. But their chickens are coming home to roost in terms of the immigration problem. You know, people in the States and in Europe are complaining about the wave of immigrants. Those immigrants are chasing wealth that's being stripped from their own countries and is now in Europe and North America, well, specifically America and Canada. So they have to follow the wealth because they're impoverished in their own countries. You know, the immigration problem is being caused by the movement of money, the movement of wealth, and the movement of commodities. If the commodities and the wealth were to move back to the places that they originally came from, you know, the mines in the Congo, you know, the oil in Angola, those immigration problems would reverse. Angolans would love to come back to Angola if they had jobs and security there, but they can't, so they have to immigrate to Europe. So, yeah, it's the globalized economy that's driving the immigration crisis.
And again, our favorite man, David Rockefeller, one of the biggest, most influential key factors in world history to force globalization than any other factor.
And his dad actually created the situation that we have today where oil is our principal fuel, when prior to that it was actually hemp. Hemp was the number one fuel on the planet for thousands of years. You know, it basically was there at the cradle of civilization. One of the first plants that early agriculturalists grew was one of the first five plants in the Fertile Crescent where civilization was born, where the agrarian way of life, the settled way of life, replaced the nomadic life, and cities grew up around hemp fields, and paper was created out of hemp, and history was recorded, the earliest histories and earliest pharmacopoeias were written on hemp paper in China and in the Middle East. You know, that was what was driving civilization and progress, and it was made illegal in the 20th century, and we're still living with the fallout of that today. You know, we wouldn't have all this argument about global warming due to CO2 emissions because of the burning of fossil fuels if we were making biodiesel out of hemp. If we had the hemp fields to supply those biodiesel, those locally producing biodiesel factories with zero emissions, zero emission biodiesel, that's what hemp offers. So, you know, would there be an argument about climate change? No, there would not, because there'd be an alternative fuel that would be readily available in any corner of the globe that has sun and soil. You could produce this biofuel. You can produce this biofuel on six continents. And in countries like Australia, you could produce vast, vast quantities of it. And you know, it's not just a biofuel. It's a food. It's a medicine. It's a textile. It's got 50,000 industrial applications.
It's close enough to being everything.
It is the perfect plant. If there was only one plant that humanity needed to survive in the future when all other species of plants can no longer live on a polluted earth, the hemp plant will still be growing and feeding us and fueling us and providing us with shelter and medicine and clothing. They know that because it's the only thing that they can plant around Chernobyl to mop up the radiation from the soil. Nothing else works, and this plant grows just as well in radioactive soil and mops up the soil and cleanses the soil as it does in fertile soil.
But what happens to that radiation afterwards? I've always wondered this. It sucks up the radiation somehow, but does that mean you're just themselves, left
with... Well, you're left with radioactive hemp plants, but at least other things can now grow in the soil. So you can replenish the biodiversity of the soil. So, yeah, look, it's not a perfect solution, but then what is the perfect solution for the worst, you know, nuclear disaster on the planet since Hiroshima?
I guess,
You know,
but there's Fukushima as well. Which was like 10,000.
Well, you know what? They're going to start growing hemp around there. That's my prediction. They're going to have to.
What, in the Pacific Ocean?
No, in the coastal regions that have been affected
by
it.
But at the end of the day,
Pacific Ocean is effed.
If genetic engineering could give us anything, cannabis that can grow in the ocean. Seaweed.
Seaweed indeed. I don't know if they'll ever reach that stage with hydroponics because of the salinity of the ocean. But, you know, definitely hydroponics has reached the stage now where we can produce absolutely perfect medicinal plants, and we can not only produce plants that are high in the molecules like THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, we can produce plants that are high in CBD, which don't have any associated psychoactive effects. They're sedative, they're tranquilizers, but not in the same sense that a Valium is. Basically, they calm your body. They can help people with all kinds of nerve disorders, multiple sclerosis, childhood ADD. They basically are an absolutely perfect non-toxic drug that can be administered with titrated doses and can be manufactured by you on your windowsill. So, you know, that's the reason why cannabis is illegal. It's too valuable. You can't let that genie out of the bottle.
Oh, Eric, it's been really nice, bro. Eric Rice, and he is the maker, the filmmaker for Drug Lord, the documentary. That's Lord with a W. And you can check it out and support them on Kickstarter. Druglord.com is the website there.
Click the green Kickstarter link.
Click the green link, incidentally. And thank you very much, bro, for your time and your expertise and your efforts to expose a little bit of the vast spectrum of scumbaggery that's out there. It's quite noble.
If they are the big tree, we are the small axe. Bob Marley.
Indeed. Have a good time, ladies and gentlemen.
Job bless.
Thank you very much for listening.
Good night.
You are the only exception.